Sorry for the delay. It is 10:05, and we're going to go ahead and call this meeting to order. There's a quorum present. If you can all join me for the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Bringing us on to item number three. This is for discussion and possible action. Consideration and possible approval of the agenda for the June 15th, 2021 meeting. Is there any public comment today regarding the agenda? For folks out in Zoom land, you can use star six or the raise your hand feature. We'll just give it a moment here. Not seeing any public comment. Commissioner Gilman, do you have any questions or comments regarding today's agenda?
None, sir. Thank you.
Vice Chairman Mitchell?
No. Good to go.
All right. Would you entertain a motion, please?
Absolutely. For the record, Commissioner Mitchell, I move to approve today's agenda as presented.
Second.
All right. There's a motion and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All right, motion passes unanimously. Thank you. Bringing us on to item number four. This is for discussion and possible action. Consideration and possible approval of the minutes for the April 2021 meeting. Is there any public comment regarding the minutes for the April 2021 meeting? Not seeing any public comment. Commissioner Gilman, you have any questions or comments?
No, sir. Thank you.
Vice Chairman Mitchell, anything?
No. Minutes look good. Thank you.
All right. Do you entertain a motion?
For the record, Commissioner Mitchell, I move to approve the minutes for the April 20th, 2021 meeting.
I'll second.
Motion and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Motion passes unanimously. Thank you. Moving right along to item number five. This is today's consent agenda. Is there any public comment regarding today's consent agenda? Not seeing any public comment. Commissioner Gilman, do you have any questions or comments regarding the consent agenda?
None, thank you.
All right. Vice Chairman Mitchell, anything?
No, thank you.
All right. Entertain a motion, please.
Yeah. I, Commissioner Mitchell, move to approve today's consent agenda as listed in our agenda.
I'll second.
All right, there's a motion and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Motion passes unanimously. Thank you. Bringing us right along to item number six. This is public comment. Public comment regarding any item that is not on today's agenda. Please limit your comments to 3 minutes. Is there any public comment today? All right. Ms. Gay, you have the floor.
Thank you. I already put it in the chat column, but I'll go ahead and read what I have. Painted Rock resident, I'd like to thank you for offering a hybrid version of meeting attendance, such as Zoom. I encourage the county to continue offering a virtual attendance option. For those of us unable to attend in person, it's a great way to be able to stay involved and aware of all the work our county is doing. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for that, Ms. Gay. And just so that you know, we have made an investment and we will continue to offer Zoom going forward. So thank you for that.
Fabulous. Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other public comment? Not seeing any public comment, we will move on to item number seven. This is discussion only. For those that are not familiar, we are going to not take any public comment on this. We're going to have a presentation and discussion with Walker & Associates about the 2021 legislative session, including bills and new laws affecting Story County and Nevada. You have the floor.
Good morning. It's very nice to see you.
Likewise.
For the record, Mary Walker with Walker & Associates. And just as a matter of introduction, we do have the Western Nevada Legislative Coalition, which we started about 23 years ago. It includes Carson Douglas Lyon and Story. And that gives us a lot more clout and a lot more, position in order to get our viewpoints across to the legislature. And it's worked very, very well. So as you are aware, the 2021 session is over. And this session, I guess I would describe as a defensive session. we had 454 bills. Which we monitored, and several of the bills, they would have had very large fiscal impacts to our counties, particularly the justice reform bills. We provided several amendments to the sponsors, and generally they accepted almost all of our amendments. Some we did not get, but in the end, the bills were amended to be much more moderate and reasonable than when we started. With the COVID, it was very interesting because the building was closed, and we thought now we're going to have lack of access to legislators. But what I found actually is legislators were very, very willing to meet with us very quickly. And I would like to thank Commissioner Mitchell and Mr. Osborne. We've gone to dozens of legislators in different meetings, and I think that our effort really did produce a very good result for Story County. I want to let you know, county staff got each one of those 454 bills, and this guy right there got every one of them. And I just want to let you know, it's a tremendous amount of work of your county staff, and I appreciate Mr. Osborne, the district attorney, the sheriffs, all of your departments did a great job in getting back to us on these bills. The vast majority of them are administrative. They're operational, and they're not real policy-type bills. But the policy-type bills come to you, of course. So it worked very well, and we really appreciate all of their help. I'd like to just go through a couple of bills, and then Steve will also go through some of them. AB 116, court fines and fees, originally that would have taken away our court fines and fees and forfeitures away from our courts and given it to the schools. Overall, it would have cost local governments about $30 million statewide. We were able to work with the sponsor, and they accepted an amendment that I had the Carson City court clerk draw up for us with the DA, and they accepted that. And so those are the types of negotiations we had with them, and it worked very well. AB 196, lactation rooms in courthouses, there is a requirement to do that, but there's also some wiggle room in there that if the court administrator, if it's not feasible, then you don't have to do it. And I think particularly with these old courthouses that you wouldn't have to do that. On AB 249, construction hours, we worked with the sponsor of that. That would have required all local governments statewide to enact local construction hours, which would have really impacted our development in Northern Nevada, but also at TRIC. So we were able to negotiate with the sponsor, and she amended the bill to only affect HOAs, so we're not affected by that anymore. Some of the other ones... the SER 11, I know we have another item there, but I'll just very quickly. Originally, that would, we know, allowed a private business to have its own county, including police powers, judicial powers, taxation powers, building and safety powers. There was a lot of opposition on at the legislative level on both sides of the House, Republican, Democrat, Senate, and Assembly. And the bill was turned into a study, which has to be completed by December 31st. As far as the study goes, I checked, and so far the membership of the committee has not been decided yet. I spoke with some legislators yesterday, and they're still waiting for the processing of the paperwork on how they would select those folks. SB 107, wrongful termination, that would have allowed a person to file wrongful termination suits over years, and current law is 2 years. This would have extended that to years. We were able to fix that bill, so that does not affect us. A couple of other things, SB 327, discriminatory practices. It was amended at our request to not pertain to rural local governments. That would have dealt with hiring sheriff's officers not hiring them, but promotion of sheriff's officers and how you have to do certain things, and we were able to get out of that bill. SB 390, suicide hotline bill, that enacts the 988 National Suicide Hotline, which is required by federal law. But it also allow grants to jurisdictions, including counties, from the opioid lawsuit money. They currently have $45 million. And what they want is for this money to go towards drug addiction programs and mental health programs. So that's something to watch in the future. Steve has a few bills he'd like to.
I've got to find my glasses. Good morning, commissioners. For the record, Steve Walker. In the Walker & Associates business, I represent, I follow public works, water, natural resource bills. Let Mary handle the hard stuff. The first bill that I want to talk about is AB 86, wildfire recovery. Let me go back. There is an aspect of the legislature that that a lot of people don't know, but it is the coordination of the local government lobbyists themselves. We meet every Monday and go through the bills, and it's very important because the lobbyists from Washoe County and Clark County represent 90% of the population. But there is that coordination, and it's very important to our process. And we're important to it because, again, of the Western Nevada Legislative Coalition. So that just be aware of that process. It was very generally, there were very few water bills this session, and only a handful passed, and I'll get specific to that. AB 86 wildfire. If you start a wildfire, you could not recover the expense. You could not go after the person that caused the wildfire unless it threatened human life. And so in wildland fire, that rarely occurs, and so persons, you couldn't go after the money. That's now been removed, and you can try to get your money back on wildfire suppression. AB 211, subdivision impact on wildlife. This was basically said that every subdivision, every tentative map had to go to the Department of Wildlife. They had 30 days to review it, and it was they had to do that. Now it got amended through a lot of work that basically you don't have to do it on any infill element, which would almost involve all your commercial properties. And it's a may instead of a shall. You do have to submit your tentative map to the Department of Wildlife, to NDOW, just like you have to do it to the state engineer and it sometimes to the PUC. That's there. And it allows the Department of Wildlife's board to actually, they may charge a fee for the review of that map. The fee would be $250 a map and time $5 an acre. And so it is somewhat minimum. It's not it's the developer impact, but it does have some impact on development. Another bills I handle are the cannabis bills, and there's a bunch of those this time. AB 341 is Cannabis Consumption Lounge. It passed. A companion bill, Cannabis Events, didn't. And what these bills are trying to address is in the passage of the cannabis laws in Nevada, you cannot use the product except in private residence. Well, when I don't know how many million a year visitors come to Las Vegas, but that's one of the Sin City's components now, and there's really no place to use the product. And so these bills are trying to address that. And now there's one, it got very much modified. So a lounge basically can be two things. It can be located adjacent to an existing retail facility, or it can be independent. They're going to allow 20 of them throughout the state, and 10 of them have to meet a real hard-to-define requirement that they have to be the applicant for the lounge has to have, be a social equity applicant. And the Cannabis Compliance Board will define that. It's basically persons affected by previous laws relating to cannabis. That's what the affected applicant, that's the basis of how they'll start the definition. AB 363, transient lodging, that bill said anybody that had short-term rentals had to do a million things. We worked hard to try to get the smaller counties out of it, and or other, like Douglas County is doing right now in the middle of doing their own ordinances. And we got there with the, it did get exempted to 700,000 population or over, so strictly Clark County. I'm mentioning these bills because I think we're going to see them again. There's going to be some return on these things. SB 94, a Settlemyer bill on roads, public roads through private land. I know Story County, it's almost all private land. And so this bill would have some impact. It basically says in counties under 100,000 population, where a public road goes through a private property, the private property owner can have an unlocked gate. And in all counties, based on the Federal Land Management Agency approval, an unlocked gate may be constructed. And it's mostly a grazing issue, but that could affect you. SB 98, Story County joining Carson Water Subconservancy District. Congratulations, Story County. SB 150, tiny houses. A tiny house is defined as a house 400 square feet or less. It can be on a foundation, or it can be on wheels, on axles. The bill started out as a tiny house could be built basically any zoning area. We got it amended to, again, in counties under 100,000, you have to have one zoning district where a tiny house is allowed, and it's going to mandate that. Typically, that would be SFR, single-family residential, or tiny house park. On the tiny house park, my background in water told me, well, if you're going to have that, make sure you have community sewer and water. You would not want a tiny house park with individual wells and septics. We got that into the bill. A bill that everybody's looking at from a public works standpoint, AB 410, construction manager at risk. 410 basically dealt with how you would select the risk, the construction manager at risk, and it can't be on a bid amount. It has to be on qualifications. Additionally, it limits applications for a public work job by a construction manager at risk to once every 4 years. So it does limit that, the use of the same construction manager at risk on all your jobs. The more important, too, from a local government standpoint or in small 100,000 or less counties, is SB 141. It basically took the sunset that you could, that was on, in existing legislation that would not have allowed you to use construction managers at risk past 2021. I'm wrapping up. AB 6 is temporary changes. It's a state engineer's bill. It allows individuals to protest a temporary change of a water right, and it gives the state engineer the discretion to hold a hearing on that protest. That didn't exist before, and the temporary changes, some of them weren't so temporary, and that you do need the ability to protest them. AB 333, stormwater retention, Washoe County bill, that they wanted exemption when you create impervious areas, and that water runs off, and you as a as a requirement to build, have to store that water. And it's usually analyzed on a 6-hour, 25-year storm, how much water that would be. That storage, you don't have to have a water right for it. That was never clarified in the language. It now applies to all counties. It was specific to Washoe County. We changed it to all counties, where if you require stormwater detention, you're not going to be subject to Chapter 533. 533 is where it would require a water right permit. And so I don't know what your requirements are, but overall, it's actually a good bill. AB 354, another state engineer, it was water banks. And AB 356, it was water conservation. I will say the state engineer's bills, seven of them, one passed, and one was completely amended. The one that passed is the water banks would have allowed agricultural water right users to put water into a bank for use for commercial and industrial. And it's a concept that's being looked at throughout the West, but it went way too far, way too quick, and became unpopular. AB 356, water conservation, that was also, you conserve water as an agricultural user. You can sell it, again, not for another agricultural use, but for commercial, private, M&I, municipal, industrial. That bill was just completely taken over by the Southern Nevada Water Authority, and they changed it into a non-functional turf, and they are going to use it to remove non-functional turf in Las Vegas. If, in fact, they completely remove non-functional turf, non-functional turf is a new definition to me, and I've been in the business a long time. Non-functional turf is commercial turf, basically, places where grass is planted and it's not walked on. In their calculation in Southern Nevada, if they could take it all out, it will increase their water supply by 10%. And so it was significant. I'm bringing it up because it's the way it's going to go nationally, or not in the West, even. You're going to see commercial turf be basically non-existent as a water conservation. And Nevada is the first state that's actually made that move. But with the drought on the Colorado River, I think others will follow suit. With that, those are kind of the bills I thought were important and specific to Story County. Mary and I enjoy working with Story County. And again, I'd like to thank the staff. I got tired of seeing you guys all the time, and maybe 2 years will be fine. Thanks.
Thank you. Commissioner Gilman, do you have any questions for the Walkers?
Other than thanking them very much for the effort and the wins that we enjoyed, thank you for the report.
Vice Chairman Mitchell, do you have anything?
Just echoing the thanks. While we were certainly defensive in this session, I think some people might consider a fair amount of what happened at the legislature offensive. But the staff did a fantastic job getting responses back, and the Walkers always do an excellent job. If not getting us the things we want, making sure we're not subject to the things we don't want, and that's often the case. So thank you.
Yep, and I will echo what my fellow commissioner said. Thank you for your hard work this season. It was definitely an interesting one, so hopefully next legislative season will be a little more relaxed. I think that's it. So did you have anything, County Manager?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, and I just want to say the same. I think the two of you are humble in your presentation and what you actually provided for us throughout this session. Without you, Mary, I mean, we would have been able to do lobbying and stuff, but you really got us into all of the senators and many of the assembly in all of these different meetings. Walking around that building with you, it's very clear you can walk into any office and the staff, they respect you. The senators and assembly people respect you, and they let you in even when they're busy and say, I literally have 4.5 minutes, go. You know, they will still hear you, and because of you, they were able to hear us and you getting us into those offices. And then during the Zoom days, you were able to get the same. So very deeply, thank you for what you did for us this year.
All right. bringing us on to item number 8. This is for discussion and possible action. This is an update discussion and provide direction to county staff and lobbyists regarding SCR 11. Which is formerly BDR 1109 and 1148, Interim Legislative Committee to study Innovation Zone draft legislation and other properly related matters. County Manager Osborne.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Yes.
Excuse me. I would like to disclose that I'll recuse. I do hold a pecuniary interest in properties that could well be identified as a conflict in this issue. So, therefore, I'm going to recuse from discussion or voting on the issue. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner Gillen.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll proceed. Austin Osborne for the record. And then also Mary Walker's with us and Steve Walker. At this point, for your background on each commission meeting, we've asked the commissioners to give direction to staff and lobbyists on various bills affecting the county with the end of the general session passed. But now with the SCR 11 Innovation Zone study still proceeding, I welcome you to give an update, what you know about the committee, what's happening, and then we can circle back and talk about what the board would like to give direction to staff and lobbyists. If you like, Mr. Chairman.
That works.
Thank you. For the record, Mary Walker. So at this point, the legislature is in the process of appointing the committee members. There's three from the Senate, three from the Assembly. In the Senate, the Republicans have one member, and there's two Democrat members. And it's same thing in the Assembly. There's will be one Republican and two Democrats. So that is in the process right now. I would think we would know who those committee members are this week. I do know they have an interim finance committee meeting next Tuesday, and they just got the membership out, just on those. So we are starting to see the membership and also the legislative commission. We have those memberships, so we're just starting to see the membership come. I think once we see the membership, we can strategize more on how we want to approach it. I think it's a very good opportunity to get the questions and concerns that we have had out in the open during this study. So I look forward to it, and it has to be done by December 31st, and they are requiring at least one meeting a month.
Anything else?
That's it for now.
We have a couple comments, Mr. Chairman, if you'd like.
Go ahead, Austin.
I think Mary pretty much covered everything, Austin Osborne, for the record. At this point, we're not sitting and to see what happens internally as staff and with our consultants. We're putting all the data together right now, literally as we speak, and making sure that we're prepared for the questions that are going to come about in the interim study as far as financial impacts, housing impacts, infrastructure, and other matters that may be tied into the interim study. We're getting prepared to know where all the money is being made and where it's going, and abated tax dollars perhaps that might be in Story County that end up unabated in someone's pocket in a neighboring county that buys a washing machine or a car or, you know, various other things that people do. So that process has begun already and will proceed through the entire interim session.
Thank you, Austin. Is there any public comment regarding this item? Anybody out on Zoom, *6 to unmute yourself. You can use the raise your hand feature. We'll give it just a moment here. And anybody in the audience, if you'd like to comment on this. Eileen, you are the only one, so you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to continue to thank the county for following this issue and keeping us informed as the direction of the study becomes evident, and I look forward to further updates. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you. Is there any other public comment regarding this item? Not seeing any. Vice Chairman Mitchell, do you have anything?
I don't. I mean, I'm happy to make a motion to continue to direct staff and lobbyists to follow this issue and to maintain the position that we have so far. I think that's probably the the most prudent at this point is to continue to support the principles and concepts that we have supported throughout our interaction with this idea.
I think that'd be a great idea.
All right. And I, Commissioner Mitchell, move to direct county staff, lobbyists, and professional services to consider appropriate research, analyses, and actions on SCR 11, which is the Innovation Zone Interim Study, which will best protect and represent the county, to continue opposing separatist government concepts, and to promote economic and land development through existing framework in the 2016 Master Plan of Story County.
I will second that motion. So there is a motion and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes unanimously. Thank you to the Walkers. Thank you, County Manager Osborne. Moving right along to item number 9. This is discussion only. There will be no public comment and no action taken. Committee and staff reports. As we always do, we are going to start off with the Sheriff's Office. All right. Moving right along to the Fire Department, Chief Onkar.
Commissioners, Jeremy Longcar for the record. I'll make it real brief. NV Energy's here in the crowd, which a lot of our stuff has to deal with that. So I do want to take the opportunity to talk to everyone. We did get out our first wildland fire of the season. It was in Douglas County. I know I received some calls about it, and the smoke column was pretty large where people were seeing it, but we did commit some resources out there. One Type 3 engine from our agency, and utilizing NV Energy staff, we were able to get the dozer down there as well. So it's going to be an active season. I just like our community to keep that in mind when they're out and enjoying the beautiful sights in Story County. Please be fire safe out there. Other than that, was glad to see Mr. Regan on the agenda today. We did finish up some fuels work in cooperation with their staff that they're helping fund here in Virginia City on a historic project. And it was an old hose house, and without stealing his thunder, I'll let him get to that later, but I do want to thank them, and I'm glad to see him here joining us today. And I have any, take any questions if you have any.
All right. Thank you for that, Chief. Commissioner Gilman, do you have any questions for Chief Longcar today?
I do not.
Vice Chairman Mitchell, anything?
No. Good to go. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. Moving right along to Public Works, Jason Wersbicki.
Morning, Chairman, Commissioners. I just have a couple quick things today. We are actively working on the drainage project down in Mark Twain again. And I'll go ahead and give Mike Northam's report as well, if that's okay with you guys.
Go ahead.
The IT project is full steam ahead and going as scheduled. Propane tanks are in the process of being changed out today as we speak. And all other projects are making forward progress. Do you gentlemen have any questions?
Commissioner Gilman, do you have any questions for Jason / Mike?
No, thank you, Jason. Thank you.
All right. Vice Chairman Mitchell, anything?
No, thanks.
All right. You are off the hook, Jason. Thanks for that report.
Have a good day, gentlemen.
You too. Moving right along to dispatch, Becky Parsons. You with us today?
I'm right here. Sorry about that. Becky Parsons for the record. We are currently still on track for getting the radio switched over on the 23rd, and that's all I've got to report.
Thank you for that. Commissioner Gilman, do you have any questions for Becky?
None.
All right. Vice Chairman Mitchell, anything?
No, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Becky. Moving right along to emergency management. I know Joe's here. You have anything, Joe?
I do a few things here. Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, thank you.
Thank you.
It pleases me to be able to report that from an emergency management standpoint, we have begun the winding down process with COVID. We're putting away equipment, we're putting it into storage, distributing excess supplies, businesses and individuals to various company organizations, and kind of moving back into a normal emergency management related function. As for a COVID report, as of June 9th, Story County had a total of 112 cases over that 15-month period, which is rather amazing to me that we had that low of a situation. Due to the nearly no cases in the Quad County, it's extremely low on a weekly basis. Carson City Health and Human Services and Health Coalition are no longer reporting new cases to us as it is just so minimal. However, between June 9th and today, we did pick up apparently one new case, but had not actually been notified of it until I checked on something this morning. So now we have a new grand total of 113 cases. You know, Story County's weathered the pandemic quite well, I would say. From our connection to the Carson City Health and Human Services organization, which was phenomenal, they really took care of Carson City when they really did not have an obligation to do so. To the team spirit within county government that made preparations and acquisitions of supplies and equipment a breeze. You know, to the community spirit of the cooperativeness within the businesses, both large and small, to the individual citizens and residents, we owe them all a thanks for their participation and cooperation. We used the contagious disease emergency plan that we put in place in 2019, which was just in time. The citizens and business community all made the county approach and actions easier to accomplish for all of us. Everyone weathered the pandemic in true Comstock spirit. Laura Mather, Honey Tapley, Stacy York left other county duties and virtually transferred to emergency management duties over the last 15 months and made testing and vaccination pods work in the worst of weather and the heat of last summer. The Story County Jeep Posse members never missed a beat and provided personnel to help with traffic at pods, set up, and takedown. The Sheriff's CERT personnel pitched in also and provided additional staffing as needed with the vaccination and testing sites. I personally thank them all for what they did to make Story County look capable, effective, and professional in handling pandemic matters in our county, as well as, or maybe even better than, in some cases, the big guys, if you will. I hated wearing masks all the time and everywhere I went, the same as all of you. But the cases of regular flu were down drastically, barely reportable on a national basis. And personally, I have not run into a single person in my circle of areas that I found that had a common cold during that period from February to now. We've all developed some really good sanitation habits like surface cleaning and hand washing more often and even regularly using hand sanitizer. Hopefully, we will continue these healthy habits into the future. Story County is now open and running hard. Enjoy it. But remember, it can happen again. Another pandemic can come along at any time, and I pray that that does not happen soon, I tell you. Stay safe. Wash your hands often. Continue to sanitize your surfaces. And be prepared should it happen again. With that, that would be the end of my report. Unless there are any questions for commissioners.
Thank you for that, Joe. Commissioner Gilman, do you have anything?
I do not. Thank you.
All right. Vice Chairman Mitchell?
No, just to echo the thanks to everyone who pitched in and got us through it.
Agreed. I am definitely glad that is behind us.
Pretty so, much.
Thank you for your efforts, Joe.
Thank you.
All right. Moving right along to community relations. Laura Mather.
Thank you. Good morning. For the record, Laura Mather, Community Relations Coordinator. Just briefly back to COVID, as I've previously mentioned, there will no longer be, at this time, COVID-19 testing within Story County. However, Carson City Health and Human Services has provided a resource flyer that talks about where you can go to get tested, all of the different resources. Interestingly, there are now home tests that you can do as well. Our IT department has posted it on Story County's website. Rad Strategies shared it for us on all of our social media, so it's out in several places if anybody has any questions. And as always, they can contact community relations or emergency management with any questions on that. Also, as a reminder, get healthycarsoncity.org. Any information, whether it's statistics on the pandemic, where to get vaccinated, testing, all that good stuff. Moving to more positive stuff, we have a lot of great things going on in Story County this summer. Mark Twain Community Center asked me to share their events that they have coming up. So in July, they have a community rubbish sale with Kim's ice cream truck. In August, they have Hawaiian movie night with pizza. September is family bingo night. October is a craft and health fair with the mammogram and mammovan and blood drive, along with flu shots. November, they have Thanksgiving food boxes. And December, they have a spaghetti feed with Santa and the sheriff. So if anybody wants further information on that, they can go to marktwaincc.org and go to their events webpage. In addition, UNR's Story County Extension has a lot of great programs coming up. So 4-H camps, there's 4-H Arts and Crafts for Kids, which will be on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Babysitting classes, which will be on Wednesdays, each Wednesday. STEM, the Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math teaching will be on Tuesdays and Thursdays. They also have Healthy Kids, Healthy Schools. The 4-H Club has the Comstock Hot Shots, Food Lovers Cooking Sessions, the Comstock 4-H Community Club. In addition, there are adult programs, Bingo Size, Taekwondo, Gardening 101, Home Ecology, so all kinds of really great things that are happening this summer to get us all out and about. And for additional information on that, you can call the UNR Extension at 887-2252, and again, always everybody's welcome to call Community Relations as well for any questions on that, and that is the end of my report.
Thank you for that, Laura. Commissioner Gilman, do you have any questions for Laura today?
No questions, just a comment, Laura, and for everybody. I think it's time to celebrate how wonderful this county is, and we're on the move following the pandemic, and it's to the benefit of the entire county, and thank that department and the hard work that's gone into it. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Vice Chairman Mitchell, do you have anything?
No, thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
All right, moving right along, BCTC, Denny Dotson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioners. Denny Dotson for the record, Tourism Director. We all know that it was a challenging year last year. And, you know, whether you're a resident or a merchant or a county official, you had an opinion. And we were all on the same page. But last Friday we were. That was because we had a welcome back barbecue. And it was neat to see everybody come together and look forward, not look back. We served over 500 meals and received about $1,067 in donations that will go to the 4th of July fireworks. So again, it was a great time, something our staff put together, and I think that we may see it continued. It looks like everybody liked it, and we may put it in the budget again for future years. Just to give a quick update on the VCTC, it looks like our revenue projections as we come to a close for this fiscal year, our tourism tax is up about $100,000 to budget, which is great. And our lodging is at budget, but the last two periods have been trending well over 2019. So we're seeing a great trend right now. Marketing programs are in full swing, including Everyone is a Local, the Third Thursdays campaign, which this Thursday, we hope to see everybody out on the boardwalk supporting our merchants in the evening, as well as digital boards. We invested in a large amount of digital boards that will be hitting the region, including I-80 a little bit, starting in July 1st. As far as events, on the 26th, you have Women with Wheels car show. It'll be our first car show of the year. I expect it to be a little bit bigger than the last couple of years' turnout. Hot August Nights is kind of co-sponsoring that with them. It'll be down at East Street and Silverland parking lot. Obviously, the 4th of July is right in front of us. We are looking forward to our first full parade with an announcer in more than a year and a half. So bring your kids, bring your candy, and have a great time. We'll have the concert from the Comstock Cowboys and a wonderful fireworks display. Speaking of Hot August Nights, we'll be doing a walkthrough with them this week as well. They are sold out. We are 450 cars, so there is a waiting list. We are 100% sold out. That'll be our first full road closure, too, for special events in more than a year and a half. Finally, Piper's Opera House continues to soar. They are getting booked. I just shake my head. So I'm really looking forward to more convention space with the Freight Depot, with the Gold Hill Depot. It's been used two or three times. It's a big need and an opportunity for us to really change the economic impact here in Virginia City as we recover because of the convention space, the meetings, the overnight stays, and all that stuff that comes with that. So having facilities is going to be a wonderful thing. Piper's is absolutely packed right now with all kinds of activities, including bingo Thursday night. If you haven't been, it's not your typical bingo. It's a lot of fun. It's a DJ. It's themed. Your first drink is free. If you have if you buy a bingo card, we had 70, 75 people at the last place, and it was a little bit ruckus, so it was fun. And then finally, just to close it up, the VCTC will also be meeting in person, our first time in this room in July. We'll try that and see how it goes as we go forward. Any questions?
Thanks, Denny. Commissioner Gilman, do you have any questions for Denny?
None, thank you.
Vice Chairman Mitchell?
No, thanks.
All right. You mind recap on what time bingo is on Thursday?
Pardon me?
What time's bingo?
Bingo's at 7 p.m.
7. And yeah. That's every Thursday or just once?
That'll
a month?
Be every the third Thursday, along with the third Thursday. The businesses are in town are staying open from 5 to 8 p.m.
Gotcha. Third Thursday. All right. Thanks for that.
You bet.
We're going to bounce back to community relations with Honey Tapley.
Good morning, Commissioners. Honey Tapley for the record. For the most part, since I've been working with the county, I've been mostly helping out with emergency management. But as Joe and Laura have both already said, you know, the COVID efforts on the outside are kind of winding down. And so my role is shifting more toward the community relations aspect. And part of, well, most of my job revolves around COVID, and as much as we want to forget that COVID exists, there are still going to be some long-reaching effects throughout the community for, you know, an undetermined amount of time. And one of the areas that has been an issue was educationally, and not through the fault of the school districts or anything, but just how they had to change up their programs to accommodate social distancing and all those sorts of measures. So I started researching things that kids could do from home, because I know a lot of families have incorporated homeschooling. And I wanted it to kind of relate to how they could be a part of the community. And I found through the Nevada Department of Agriculture and the UNR Cooperative Extension, I found a book. It's called Weed Busters, which is actually a really informative activity book. And it talks about all the noxious weeds in Nevada. And they're more than just weeds. They can cause a problem for fire safety. And since the drought is kind of in a big issue at the moment, this book addresses what the weeds look like, how to, you know, take care of them, who to report them to if they needed to be reported. There are puzzles and different things to do as a family, and so I thought that, you know, if kids need something to do out in the summer to get out of the parents' hair, and if they also needed a little bit of an educational boost that they might not have gotten throughout the year, that this would be good. And so we reached out to UNR, and Lisa Taylor, who's sitting back there, has generously given community relations a lot of these books. So we will have them at our office at 10 South B Street. And the cool thing, well, I think it's cool, but in the back, you can become a certified weed buster. So who doesn't want to be a certified weed buster? I mean, I'm going to do it. But anyway, we just thought it was a way to kind of involve the community and maybe keeping attention on what would be happening, you know, through also fire prevention with the emergency management and things like that. It's kind of all of our responsibility to keep paying attention to those small details. And that is it.
Thank you for that, honey. Commissioner Gilman, do you have any questions for Honey Tapley?
None, thank you.
All right. Vice Chairman Mitchell, anything?
No, thank you.
All right. I'll definitely grab one of those pamphlets from you. Thank you. Oh, awesome. I will join you in being a weed buster. All right, moving right along. Water and sewer. We have Mike Nevin joining us today. Maybe not. Comptroller's office. I know you got a lot of agenda items. Do you have anything else?
Nothing at this time.
All right. Thanks, Jennifer. How about the assessor's office? Jana?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I have nothing new to report so far today.
All right. Planning department, Kathy or Lindy?
Oh, good morning. This is Kathy. Nothing today except what I have on the agenda a little bit later.
Sounds great. Thank you. Recorder's office, Marnie Martinez.
Good morning. Nothing to report today.
All right. How about the IT department, James Dean?
Good morning, Commissioners. James Dean, Story County IT Director. Just a quick update. The engineering on the tower at the sewer treatment plant has been completed. The soil analysis is done, so we're going to be moving dirt down there pretty quickly and starting to get that tower erected. And then as Jason Wersbicki at Public Works said, the IT building is moving along very quickly. I wanted to give a shout-out to Mike Northen because on a side project for mounting some microwave masks at both the Divide facility and the Public Works building, he was able to shave off about $1,400 off the project by selecting a vendor that I wasn't aware of. So thank you, Mike, very much for that. And that's all I have.
Thanks, James. Commissioner Gilman, do you have any questions for James?
None, thank you.
Vice Chairman Mitchell?
Thank you.
All right. Thanks again, James. Human Resources, Toby. All right. How about community development? Martin Azevedo. Nothing? Community chest, Eric Schoen.
Yes, good morning, Commissioners. This is Eric. Are you able to hear me?
Loud and clear.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Hey, you all know that we're going gangbusters right now because our summer programs are in full swing. If you come by our community center, you'll see kids spilling out the doors, which is exactly what we want to see. I think I talked about enrollment being way up to almost 100 capacity this time around, which is fantastic to see after last summer. What you may not know is that, or you may remember, that we have turned 30 this year. So we are choosing, we've selected a week in the middle of July as our 30th birthday celebration week, which is the week of July 12th. Specifically, there's two events that I would like to invite everybody to, including commissioners and everybody at this meeting and anybody listening in. The first is on Wednesday, the 14th of July, and we have Facebook posts and other ways of getting the word out. So you might have seen this already, but on Wednesday, July 14th, we will be dedicating the Story County Community Library in the memory of Lucy Bolden, longtime Virginia City librarian who basically carried the library on her back for decades, or at least many, many years. She was the librarian and really turned a lot of young people onto the passion of reading. So that'll be on Wednesday, the 14th at 11 o'clock up in the library space of our community center. We'll have a small little program, probably not more than half an hour. Then we'll have nibbles for folks to enjoy. And then from that point forward, the library can be affectionately known as Lucy's Library. And then on the 16th, Friday, July 16th, from 1 to 5, we will sort of have our more traditional birthday party. It will be kind of an open house style, so people will be able to walk through. We'll have food and fun available. And at 3 o'clock on that day, we are dedicating a tree that's in the patio in front that's been created by the kids. We'll be dedicating the tree there in honor of Sean Griffin, who was previous executive director and the founding executive director, in honor of his years of service to the county and to community chest. So those are two things to look forward to. If people have questions, they're free to reach out to me however they'd like to. And that's all I have.
Thank you for that, Eric. Commissioner Gilman, do you have anything for Eric today?
Nothing, thank you.
Vice Chairman Mitchell?
Nothing.
Thanks again for the report, Eric. Keep up the good work.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. Senior Center, Stacey York.
Good morning. Stacey York, Senior Services, for the record. One update I have is in regards to our transportation and homemaker programs. Those are grant-funded programs, which every year I have to reapply for. We got notification this week that we were 100% funded again through aging and disability. So those programs will continue. And also, Lockwood Senior Center, as well as Virginia City Senior Center, is doing Bingo Size. It is an exercise program geared towards seniors that involves bingo cards. And that starts June 29th. And it will be every Tuesday and Thursday. And that is all I have.
Thank you for that, Stacey. Commissioner Gilman, do you have anything for Stacey?
Nothing, thank you.
Nice, Chairman. All right, thanks again, Stacey. Have a nice afternoon. The District Attorney's Office, Assistant DA Loomis, do you have anything?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have nothing to report today.
All right. County Manager Osborne, what good news do you have to bring?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's always great news. just to let you all know, and Mark Twain, we had a town hall on June 10th, and we had some folks show up there, and it's just open air. It's open conversation, whatever people want to bring up. The next rotation will be down in Lockwood. We'll try to find a reasonable time. Generally, there Thursday afternoons around 5 to 6 or on Saturday morning seem to be the best times for these. The next thing is I just want to thank Denny and his team for the VCTC barbecue that we had on Friday. It was really great, and we had tons of people that came up from all over the county, people from Lockwood and otherwise. It was just a tremendous event that we weren't sure was going to happen. So thank you all for putting that together. A lot of folks were involved in that. And then lastly, it was brought up about noxious weeds in the county. Every year we do sprays in Six Mile Canyon and throughout the Comstock here, and we've been working on trying to get it started in the highlands. And as you'll see down in Six Mile Canyon, the white top is coming back to levels that existed prior to all the treatments. And the primary reason is like everyone else, they cannot find employment to get people to do the sprays. So, you know, people would rather go to, you know, work in the companies and whatever and make 20, 30 bucks an hour than wear a hazmat suit in the hot sun and, you know, work in that. But it is a problem. We're trying our best working with our area conservation districts, particularly Dayton Valley and the Carson Water Subconservancy. And we don't know if we're going to be successful this year in a spray because of that. That's all I have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for that, Austin. Commissioner Gilman, do you have any questions for County Manager?
No questions.
Vice Chairman?
I was just going to say, maybe if we get some of our youth weed buster certified, we can press them into service.
There you go. Summer jobs. I like it. Thanks, Austin. Last but not least, our County Clerk, do you have anything for us? All right. Thank you to all our staff for the updates. Much appreciated. That'll do it for our staff updates. Going to bring us up to item number 10, which is board comments. I'll start off with Commissioner Gilman. Do you have anything for us today?
Nothing to offer. Thank you.
All right. Vice Chairman, anything?
Not a lot. Just, you know, really pleased with all the work that's going on so many different fronts. We still have plenty of things to work on. One of the discussions that I've been involved in recently is around housing, affordable housing, particularly up here on the Hill. And that's not unique to our area, but certainly something that's on the horizon, I think, has far-reaching impacts. So we'll continue those discussions and see what we can come up with, maybe bring to the board for consideration.
Great. Anything else?
Nope. That's it.
All right. And the only thing I want to talk about is it's been talked about twice now, but the barbecue was fantastic. I think I heard that they served about 525 meals, which probably reflects close to how many people were there. It was great to see people from all four points of the county. I really would love to see it wink wink every year. You know, it was probably the most fun I've had in the last year and a half. I know that doesn't say much because of COVID, but it was definitely a good time. The other thing was out in the Highlands, we did have a meeting with the fire department and NV Energy, talking about some not so fun things like some potential power outage, red flag related power outages. So, you know, specifically my community needs to be aware of that. But it wasn't very well attended, which was a bit of a shocker to me. But I did record it, so I'm going to put that out there for the folks that couldn't attend. Aside from that, I have nothing else. So that'll bring us on to item number 11, which is discussion only. There will be no action taken, but we will take public comment. This is presentation and discussion by the Carson Water Subconservancy District. General Manager Ed James about the Carson River Watershed Study, including watershed trends, users, resource allocation, and strategies in the watershed area. You have the floor, sir.
Good. Good morning. For the record, Ed James with the Carson Water Subconservancy. And I want to say welcome. July 1st, you'll be officially part of CWSD, and I want to say it's been long in the making. Austin was, I think, started in 2008, started informally coming to our board meetings, participating. There was a lot of work. And it's interesting, even though a little bit of Story County is in the watershed, hearing your staff reports, it's amazing how much you guys work cooperatively with the counties already in this area. And our philosophy has always been, if you work cooperatively, you can be a stronger community. It benefits everyone, and that is our goal. And we look forward, as of July 1st, officially welcoming, hopefully, some two members from Story County.
Great.
So with that, I'm going to give a brief overview of a study that we've been working on. It's called the Carson River Water Marketing Study. Oops. I want to give a little background. A couple years ago, CWSD's board had directed us to look at potential water storage in the Carson watershed. What we wanted to do is, what opportunities are there for sustainability? And of course, we have very little upstream storage. Most of our storage is in Lahontan Reservoir, which is located two-thirds of the way down. Most storage is used in the upper watershed. So we started looking at different ideas. We're going to have some funding we put aside to do this. And then this grant opportunity came with the Bureau of Reclamation to look at water marketing and sustainability. How can we enhance sustainability? And we thought, there's a good opportunity to use the funds that we had put aside and use this as a match to do a lot more than what we could originally. So we applied for the grant, and we got it. And so this gave us an opportunity to really expand some opportunities that we wanted to look in the watershed. So that's a little background. So some of the things that we looked at was understanding water trends, watershed trends. I'll go over this. It gave us an opportunity to hire Lumis and Associates. That's what you see all. This was actually a presentation they gave to CWSD's board. Looking at existing water use by the users in the watershed and some other ideas of water marketing or sustainability. How can we enhance the water supply for the future in our watershed? So with that, I'm going to talk a little bit about some water trends. If you can see in the upper graph, this is a runoff at the Carson City Gauge, and you can see that the river really fluctuates every year. I mean, because we have so limited upstream storage, we really depend upon Mother Nature. And if she's giving us a lot, there's going to be a lot coming down. If she's stingy like this year, very little. So the river really fluctuates year to year. And because we have very limited upstream storage, we have to manage within that. Years ago, there was a proposal back in the 50s and 60s to build a large dam on the Carson River. That never happened. One of the main reasons was that all the water in the Carson River has already been allocated. So if you're going to build a large dam on the upper Carson, where you can get the water. The original intent back in the 50s and 60s was to, if you stored that water in the upper watershed because of the downstream demands in the Lahontan, what they would do is just divert more water out of the Truckee River through the Truckee Canal. Because I did back in the 50s and 60s, where did that water go? Went through this thing called Pyramid Lake. It's a terminal rate. There's no benefit. We want to enhance it. Well, all of a sudden, the Pyramid Tribe said, well, wait a minute. It has a benefit. The environmental movement came along, and basically they realized that would never fly in today's. So really, developing upper watershed was not going to be there. However, we do still need a need for water, and we're talking much smaller opportunities. You know, storage that may be like 2,000 acre feet or something like that, that could get you through a summer period. The other one, I'm going to look at the chart or the table below, and I'm going to focus on the bottom line there. And this is kind of looking at what is happening in the watershed today. And this is from 1940 to 2018. And you'll see, this is the, have we have the West Fork gauge, which is at Woodford, and the East Fork gauge at the, what do you call it, the Gardnerville gauge. And this is basically what's Mother Nature giving us, what's happening in trend. And you'll see that on the West Fork, we're seeing almost an 8% decline in stream flow from 1940 to today. On the East Fork, it's about a 4% change. So we are seeing, even in the upper watershed, which has very little man-made impacts or other things going on, a reduction in flows. So this is something we have to start looking at in our planning. If you combine the two, you'll see that the overall is a little over, just under 5%. The East Fork is a much larger watershed than the West Fork and actually a higher elevation. But this kind of shows you what's happening over the long trend. The next gauge is at the Carson City. And this is now going through Carson Valley. So now you have a lot of impacts, agriculture, groundwater pumping, the interaction, and you'll see almost a 9% impact of flow. So we are seeing impacts to the river as it moves through the system. We go down to Fort Churchill, and you'll see it's just under 4%, so there's a recovery going on. That really is actually occurring because there's less agriculture today in Lyon County. There used to be a lot of agriculture to divert water out of the river. That is reduced significantly, and that's why you actually see it water coming back up, so it's not even as bad as what we see from Mother Nature. But that's a man-made impact and benefit. So now what I want to show is kind of trends, what's happening with our runoff. And this is looking at, again, we focused on the Carson City gauge, but you can look almost this at every other gauge on the watershed. The orange line is a historic period from 1940 to 59. And you'll see that in January, February, March, the river was fairly steady. It was basically not coming off. The spring runoff melt had not occurred. And then you would see the runoff occur coming up and then going down. And then you'll see in the late fall the water coming back up. And so we had, again, more sustainability flows. Recently, and this is from 2000, 2019, the blue line, we're seeing the runoff coming off earlier. We're seeing that coming off earlier. We don't have as much peaks, and you can see the dip is much lower. So we're seeing a shift in runoff patterns on the Carson. And since most of the water is used by agriculture, it's an impact on agriculture in these areas because now they don't have the water in late summer. We have very dry falls. And so this is definitely an impact not only on the water supply, but on the environment. And these are things that we look at. What's happening with flows in the river? What does that mean for habitat and wildlife? Looking at climate, so one of the things that the consultant did was looked at the Carson City climate data. And what's interesting is you can start seeing that the temperature, the blue line, is slowly going up. Now you're going to have up and down, but this is the temperature. And we're actually seeing a slight increase in temperature, which is, if you've heard, it's happening all over the West, so it's not too surprising. The bottom one is, the orange one is precipitation. And you can see it fluctuates up and down. I mean, you can have a wet, dry year, goes up and down. But what is the long-term trend? And the long-term trend is also showing less precipitation occurring. So this is something, again, as we start planning for the future, how are we going to be prepared for this as we have this warming climate and less precipitation occurring? So challenges, you know, as we move forward, we have this data. As we move forward, we have more demands. We have growth occurring. So how are we going to meet those demands in the future? And we always look at balancing the resources and balancing your agriculture, the environment, and municipalities. It's a balancing act that we are trying to achieve in this watershed. So let's kind of look at watershed users. I've already talked about how all the water is fully allocated on the river, and most of it's used for agriculture. This is the groundwater basins, and there are five major groundwater basins in this watershed. We have Carson Valley, we have Eagle Valley, which is the Carson City area, we have Dayton Valley, which includes the Mark Twain area you guys participate in. We then have the Churchill Valley, which is actually the Silver Springs area, and then the Carson Desert, which is the Fallon-Churchill County area. And you can see from here the different kind of production that is occurring. In Carson Valley, the orange is agriculture, so there's quite a bit of groundwater pumping for that. The blue line is domestic. Now, you don't need a water right for a domestic well, but domestic wells do use water. And so we calculate that, we assume 1 acre foot per domestic unit. So you can see in Carson Valley, quite a bit of water is actually used for domestic wells. You then have the immiscible use and then just general other uses in Carson Valley. And you can move through the watershed as you go through. And you can see that agriculture is a big user, but we have a lot of domestic wells, which is kind of interesting. So again, as we start planning for this, I think Melissa Mark Twain is all domestic wells. What does that impact on the flows and resources in that area? So this is something that we do in our planning. There are some dots here. The dots indicate what they call perennial yield. And the definition of perennial yield is what Mother Nature naturally recharges into that basin area. And this is something that the state engineer has used for years on allocating resources for groundwater. But I will point out to you why I don't believe perennial yield is a good indicator in our watershed. I'll start in Carson Desert, which is the Churchill County area. You'll see the dot is way at the bottom of the basis of what they produce. And actually, it's, I think it's less than 2,500 acre feet of water in that area. And most of that recharge is occurring on the Stillwater Range. But they have quite a bit of water being recharged because of agriculture. If they did not have that agricultural recharge, they would be in a world of hurt comparing because they would not be able to offset their pumping. So to them, agriculture is so important that they've actually instituted ordinances to enhance and ensure that they will have agriculture in the future. And that keeps their water table up. So perennial really doesn't work in that area. You do have where Silver Springs is. That's probably more appropriate. Perennial because the river goes around it. It doesn't go through the community where the groundwater basin is. So that really probably is a good indicator. But the concern we have out there is most of the water being used today is from domestic wells. They're on the books, over 10,000 acre-feet of groundwater rights. The perennial yield is only 1,600, but the domestic users use over 2,500. So there's a real issue of having a lot of paper water, but not very much wet water. And these are things that we're looking at in that community. You get into the Dayton Valley area, they actually have two. They have a wet perennial yield and a dry perennial yield. And you can see the wet one, basically there's plenty of water in the dry. There are some impacts. I did recently look at some well levels in the Mark Twain area, and it's interesting how the wet years in 17, 18, 19, the aquifer did rebound, at least at the one. So it doesn't mean everywhere there, but most of the wells I looked at show a rebound. So it'll be interesting to see now with the dry periods what's going to happen to your well levels. But at this point, it does not seem to have an indication or a concern in the Mark Twain area. Eagle Valley, one of the things that they have is they have perennial yield, but also identified system yield. And this is something the state engineer recognized years ago because they also have ash in Kings Canyon that they spread water into the groundwater to recharge it, and they bring water over to Mark Twain. That helps their water supply. So they actually have a better supply than what their perennial yield is. You get the Carson Valley, and you'll see here, it looks like, wow, they got a perennial yield of almost 50,000, they're only pumping about 35, so they should be in a really good shape. However, that's kind of a general overview. And the pine nuts, we actually are seeing water levels dropping. The Ruhenstrauch area, the Johnson Lane area, we are actually seeing water levels dropping, and it's going to be a real concern in the future how to meet those communities. It's interesting, none of them are immiscible use, it's all domestic use. So same thing what you have kind of up in Mark Twain, but in Mark Twain's a much better situation. So water marketing and managing strategies. And this is really kind of looking at how are we going to maintain and look at resources in the future. One of the things that's real important is looking at anything we do has to follow the Alpine Decree or Nevada Water Law. And that is something real critical. As we start developing these plants, we want to make sure those move forward. Steve Walker talked about several water bills that didn't make it, like the water banking and the water conservation. Water banking and water conservation are not new. It's something being done all over the West. However, the bills that were introduced violated the Alpine Decree. We actually had to oppose those bills because if they were brought forward, we would actually be in conflict with the Alpine Decree. And so that's why we want to work with the state engineer to ensure whatever we do work within the Alpine Decree and state. Working with interties, we do a lot of intertie connections with agencies to ensure water supply and water reliability. You know, wastewater effluent is critical. That's another source of water resource. It's interesting, 100% of the water, wastewater in this watershed is reused. for agriculture, irrigation, or some source. So there is water being used. Water leasing and water banking is something we have. We have opportunities, and we've started identifying these opportunities. Importation of water, I think it's important to understand. We talk about the Marlette water system coming in. You guys take water. It brings it over. It brings in water to Carson City. That's a huge import system there. But the Truckee Canal, that brings water from the Truckee River over to Lahontan Reservoir. That is extremely important, especially for the Newlands Project. And I'll give you an example of how important it is this year. From October 1st, which is the beginning of this water year, to today, over 75% of the water that came into Lahontan came from the Truckee River, and only 25% came from the Carson. If we did not have that Truckee Canal, we would not actually have the Newlands Project down below. Several surface things. We asked the consultant. They actually looked at a lot of, you know, off-channel surface storage, aquifer storage. They probably looked over 40 different sites in the whole watershed. And I'm not going to go into too much detail here because I want to just move forward. I know there's a lot there. But just be aware that there was a lot of research done. And a lot of them didn't pencil out for a lot of reasons. One, like off-channel storage, you build a dam in a little canyon. It's too steep. You wouldn't ever get the water resources you need. If you put in a groundwater aquifer, it's too close to the river. Flow back to the river would not actually be a storage. Also, any water being stored has to come from an existing water use. So these are part of the parameters in there. Just roughly some of the costs, some estimates of some of these sites. They fluctuate from a little over $6 million to almost $59 million. The larger one was raising Lahontan Reservoir. There was a request to us to look at that because actually the Lahontan Reservoir was designed to be raised. So we did look at that. There's a lot of issues. However, one of the things with that is even if you raise it, how many years would you actually get additional water? And so you have to look at the firm yield in that situation there. So where are we going from here? So we recently applied for another grant from the Bureau of Rec to develop a water management plan for the entire watershed, a kind of a 40-year plan of we have all those resources. In that, we'll also look at updating some of the work that the USGS has done on the Middle Carson. They have some great modeling work there, and also in the Upper Carson. So we would look at developing all that information. Douglas County has recently hired the USGS to analyze their groundwater resources. So that data set will be coming in. So we'll be able to gather all this information we've done, the USGS is doing, an enhanced look at this, and also then develop a water plan. Then on top of that, the USGS has developed these climate change. What if climate change in the future? And so we can have a plan in place, and then we'll say, what if the climate conditions continue this way? What does that mean, and is our plan sustainable based on those changes? So that's hopefully we get that grant. We do. We will have something that will probably take 3 to 4 years to complete, but we would then have a blueprint for the entire watershed to move forward. So that's all I have on this one. We do have Brenda Hunt is going to be talking briefly about our Water Connects Us All campaign. So I don't know if you want to take questions now or have Brenda first.
Let's see. Is there any public comment before we move to Brenda? Commissioner Gilman, do you have any questions?
I do not, sir. Thank you.
Vice Chairman Mitchell?
So if the climate trends continue, does this throw? You said basically all the river's water is allocated.
Correct.
And so does this potentially invalidate younger water rights? Does this create conflict? And yeah, I guess that's my first question.
Hey, James, for the record, what this would do if the trends are really bad? It's going to have a huge impact on agriculture. Because most municipalities do not use the surface water today, it's not an impact. But it may force more groundwater pumping. Now, the issue we have is if the water comes off earlier, it goes into Lahontan Reservoir, and that's when Lahontan fills in the winter and springtime. So they would actually see an increase coming there. But it then may force the communities to go to more groundwater pumping, which may pull water from the system. And so that timing is something we have to look at. What is the timing on the overall system? Timing to the upper watershed, the middle watershed, and into Lahontan. So that's going to be probably the more critical element. We also are concerned about the environment at that point. the river's going to go dry. The river will go dry this year. We're going to see many places are going to go dry. But there may be ways of using these surface waters to augment those flows in the river, to supplement that, to enhance the water supply or recharge for those communities. And that's something we want to look into our overall plan. But the overall thing is we are, you know, because we have no upstream storage, we really depend on Mother Nature, and we want to be prepared for it. So as you start developing and growing your communities, you want to make sure you have a sustainable water supply. The worst thing to do is buy, especially a surface water right, in June you're out of water, and you tell the community, that's fine, just don't turn your tap for the next 4 months, and then when the water comes back, you can get water. So it really is something that we want to plan to make sure we have something that's sustainable for the community.
Thank you. My only other question is, looking at future growth in Story County particularly, when you look at domestic versus municipal, is there a preference for one or the other? Is one more efficient than the other? Are domestic wells problematic because you're not able to actually measure what the usage is? We're using an assumption there. What's the thought as we kind of look at future growth in Mark Twain?
You know, it's a tough one because every situation's different. I mean, the reason why you have domestic wells is because you're not near a municipal water system. Domestic well, you're entitled to use 2 acre feet per acre or per domestic well. Most don't even come close to that. If you go to Silver City or Silver Springs, they're probably using less than a half an acre foot. State allocates, when they do a calculation, about an acre foot. So, you know, again, it's where they're... The issue more is if you have smaller lots, it makes sense to have a water system and you want to try to get into it. Our concern we see now, like in the Ruhenstroth area, when the water tables are dropping because of domestic wells, sooner or later you can only drill so much deeper before you're going to actually run out of water. And so you may have to bring in a municipal water system there. And that's something you want to plan for too. So you look in Mark Twain, that's why you look at kind of wells. It seems like its water tables are staying up, so there. But you can have a lot of over drawdowns, and could be an issue. That's why we try to plan ahead, so you're aware of those situations. But there really isn't a better one. It really is affects whatever community and the situation at that time.
Great, thank you, Mr. James.
And I have no questions for you.
Thank you.
So we can move on to Brenda. Thank you for your presentation.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Sorry about that. We're hoping the sound works on the video in a little bit. So my name is Brenda Hunt, and I'm the Carson Water Subconservancy's Watershed Program Manager for the Carson River. I'm going to cover our watershed literacy program effort to educate our community, encourage them to act in ways that benefit water quality and the health of the Carson River watershed. We'll focus on the launch of our second video that is called Water Connects Us All, and briefly remind folks about why this campaign, you know, took place. So I'm going to just kind of run through a little bit of that. Maybe it's off. Hold on. Yes, thank you. Is working, people. Oh, maybe it's. Sorry.
No problem.
Should we reshare?
Now, Mr. Chairman, while they're working on the laptop, maybe we can talk about your dancing skills.
Oh, you want to bring that up now?
It was a community event.
I don't think so. We do an impromptu dance class right now? Is that what you're saying?
Stretch break?
Yeah.
I'm interested in this bingo size thing. If maybe they can give us a demo on that.
The what?
Bingo size? The senior center demo? It's like a bingo exercise deal.
Yeah.
All right. Sorry about that.
No problem. You good to go?
I think we're good to go.
Awesome.
So this kind of just walks you through a little bit of the history on the Watershed Literacy Program. So it's been years in the making. It started with our Carson River Coalition Education Working Group. And a question relating, you know, how do we measure the success of the education programs that we have? And as you're aware, most of the grants these days, they want SMART goals. They want you to be able to measure your successes. And so we started, you know, brainstorming and thinking about, you know, how do we do that? And so we created a Watershed Literacy Action Plan, and that was adopted by CWSD in April 2015. The plan called for a watershed-wide survey. And so we conducted a survey of our residents, including Story County residents, in 2015, and worked with our partners and a contractor called Responsive Management to conduct statistically relevant watershed survey. It was a telephone survey with cell phones and landlines. And it looked at what residents' knowledge and attitudes towards watershed health, knowledge and watershed concepts, participation in activities or behaviors that might impact the watershed's environment. And some of the key things that we learned were that when people were asked whether they live in a watershed, 62% of the people either didn't know or didn't think they lived in a watershed. When asked where the water ultimately drains from their property, only 9% stated the Carson River without prompting. And about 87% of the residents never named the Carson River as the ultimate drainage location. And the survey indicated that once people were informed about what a watershed was, that they cared deeply about protecting it, with over 75% of residents giving it an 8 or above in a 1 to 10 rating. Also, when asked how much they personally affect the health of the Carson River watershed, 70% of the people either didn't think they did at all or they only did very little. And this indicates kind of a disconnect, because one of the main sources of pollution in our watershed is non-point source pollution, or polluted runoff, which comes from me and you and our activities in the watershed. So basically, we started this watershed literacy campaign to really look at these issues and start coming up with a way to help people understand a little bit more about the watershed. So the key overarching messages for the campaign was to connect residents' health and quality of life to the health of their watershed. We also had three kind of below-tier messages, which were protect the floodplain for future development, reducing runoff from properties to improve water quality in the watershed, and the Carson River watershed is a source of our drinking water. There are many other messages, and they'll be dealt with as the campaign moves on. So we developed and began implementation of the Watershed Literacy Program. If you guys have noticed, there's watershed signs, and you may have seen them coming in and out of, some of them say entering the Carson River watershed, and then adjacently it would say entering the Truckee River watershed or entering Dixie Valley or those types of things. And that came out of this in a project that we worked with NDOT. The I Am Carson River Watershed Campaign, PSA, stickers, and splash page. Our first film, A Walk Through the Watershed, came out on November 2019, right before the pandemic hit. And the second film, Water Connects Us All, was released just before Earth Day of 2021. So, oops. So the I Am Carson River Watershed messaging of our flagship campaign launched in November, as I said, a few months before the pandemic. Working with our partners, Neon Agency, they're out of Reno, we sought to make the campaign logo something that looks iconic and personally connects residents to the Carson River watershed. The logo was created into a sticker, and Ed's going to hand out some stickers for everybody. The back of the sticker, the back of the sticker has actions that we can all take to help keep our waters healthy. And we're kind of wanting this to be the corollary to the Keep Tahoe Blue. So we're starting to see these on the backs of people's cars and that type of thing. We worked with water purveyors to get them sent out to about 37,000 residents within the watershed in our in water bills. Not everybody was available to do that, not all, every water purveyor, but we did start to get them out. So we're really hoping that if you need any, I have some, and they're available to hand out. The logo was also made into a GIF that we are using to on everybody's website, so you can have that placed on, you know, maybe the county would like to place it on their website with that GIF, and then if you click on it, it sends you to the I Am Carson River Watershed splash page, which is here. And this splash page, this isn't the whole entire thing, but it highlights what's on the back of the sticker. Eventually, those will become clickable icons as well. But right now, it takes you to our Walk Through the Watershed film and our Water Connects Us All film, and they run back to back. There's also a Spanish version of the Walk Through the Watershed because we had Vanessa Van Coor, who is a she's bilingual, and she also was a news in a new, one of the news programs a couple years back. And anyway, she it was really easy to get the bilingual filming done at the same time. It was awesome. So with that, I wanted to show you the PSA, which is really about protecting our drinking water. The film features over 40 community members from around the watershed, reminding their neighbors to take a couple of simple actions, you know, to make a big difference in preventing pollution. So with that, I would like to show you the... I should be able to just...
In the Carson River watershed, there's one thing that connects us all.
This.
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 Seeing as most of our drinking water comes from groundwater...
And on average, our bodies are 65% water...
That makes me...
And me...
And me...
And him...
And her, too...
And her...
And you...
Y'all...
And you...
Mostly Carson River Watershed.
The rest is whiskey.
Yes, the water in every glass.
Water bottle, coffee,
or local brew is pumped directly from our watershed.
So let's look after it.
So let's look after it.
So let's look after it.
All of us.
We've launched the I Am Carson River Watershed campaign
to ask everyone in the community
to do a couple of simple things to help protect
the quality of our drinking water
and our watershed
by recycling your motor oil,
using, storing, and disposing of your chemicals responsibly,
inspecting and maintaining septic systems,
and cleaning up after you.
We keep fertilizers, paint products, and other pollutants out of our water supply.
Your actions matter. I am Carson River Watershed, and you are too.
So let's make our water
something we can all raise a glass to.
The sound worked. So that's good. Thank you. So that is the newest film. And so some of the next steps that we're going to be doing is we have a contract with Neon Agency, and it's funded through the 319 program, so the NDEP and CWSD, to do 15 to 30 additional PSAs, or 30-second PSAs, 15 additional 30-second PSAs that will look at those specific topics. And so we'll be doing, you know, somebody picking up their dog poop, somebody talking about curbing their chemical use, or, you know, helping pollinators or planting native plants, using a car wash, that type of thing. And that is going to be happening over the next 6 to 8 months, and we'll be releasing them over the next year, probably one a month or one every month and a half. So these are going to be dubbed watershed moments. Oops. And you know, we're really hoping that that kind of takes off. And we're also going to be inviting people to send in their own watershed moments. So we'll actually get people acting and doing, you know, the right thing in their watershed. So we're going to try to make this a big, huge social media event to make that happen. So that, I think, is it for my presentation. So there's our contact details if anybody is interested in getting a hold of us for any information, or if you want stickers or anything like that. Head to the splash page, which is www.iamcarsonriver.org, and that will you can see both films. One of them is about the landscape, and one of them is about the community. So that's it.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Brenda.
Yeah.
Let's see if there's any public comment from the audience. And in a second, we'll see if there's any public comment on Zoomland. Not seeing any public comment. Commissioner Gilman, do you have any questions for Brenda?
I have no questions. Thank you, sir.
Vice Chairman Mitchell, aside from more stickers, do you have any questions?
Yeah, I need a stack of stickers.
I don't have any questions, but I do thank you both for your presentation, and I would definitely like a few more stickers.
Okay.
Seriously.
We have.
thank you again.
Thank you.
Appreciate
you.
It. That is it. All right. Moving right along to item number 12. This is a discussion only. No action will be taken. We will take some public comment. Presentation and discussion with UNR Extension about the Nevada Economic Analysis Project, NEAP, for economic development analyses. Welcome.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, for this opportunity. It's greatly appreciated. For the record, I am Joe Lednicki with the University of Nevada Extension. I'm an economist with them. And I wanted to thank Austin and Laura for the help that they gave our program in getting us here today. Not great at the whole talking thing.
No problem.
But the Nevada Economic Assessment Project, or NEAP as we call it. It's a partnership between Extension and various other colleges within the university, and then as well as some of our state resources and federal partners. So the Bureau of Land Management, U.S. Forest Service, NACO, and USDA Rural Development, all partners, and some have provided funding as well for this program. And I want to thank Lisa Taylor, our extension educator for Story County in Carson City, and Dr. Tom Harris, who's the director for the University Center for Economic Development and extension specialist as well, and one of the PIs on the grants that fund this project. So, the NEAP. The NEAP is a process to develop and maintain an extensive data repository, set of analytical methods that are meaningful, consistent, and verifiable. In layman's terms, demographic, social, fiscal, economic data points. So population, age, things of that nature, industry information. The use of this data and analytical tools are used to engage and educate agencies and communities and assist with planning and policy analysis. So obviously many of those partner organizations of ours are public land agencies. There's always going to be a little bit of headbutting between local counties, local governments, and the public land agencies. They both want to be able to use the land. We're hoping that this data, this entire project, helps with finding a quantitative method to find the best use of those lands so that everyone can hopefully be happy with. This data can be used for the land use planning, for policy assessment. The data is generally the same beginning data that's needed for NIFA grants, NEPA grants, when you're applying for those. It's also the basis for economic impact assessments for new industries and things of that nature.
Excuse me, sir. Do you mind speaking? I'm just a little bit. There's some people online that can't hear you.
I apologize. Yes.
No problem.
All right. So the data sources that we use in the report, it's all sourceable federal data, state data, items that are respected and verifiable. So we use DETR, State Department of Taxation, U.S. Census Bureau, things of that nature. We're not going to present something that, you know, some nonprofit says, hey, look at our data, this is the best. We're going to verify, source, ensure that that data is accurate, ground truth it within the local counties. Within the data, we try to keep a historical frame of mind to keep that baseline. So be it from 2010 to present or earlier on, so we can get a trend, a baseline to see where things have been, where they're going. It's something that was even more important when COVID hit. Obviously, well, down in Las Vegas, we were having about 34% unemployment back a year ago or so. That's not normal. When we have this baseline data, we can see what it should be around that 5-4% range. So in times of turmoil, right now everything's going to be inflated or deflated due to COVID. You know, in the next year or two, we can look at that trend data, see where we should be aiming to get back to. If you do look at the data, you will see that some of the data is a little bit older at this point. That's just due to, this is our 14th county that we're presenting to. The first in a year and a half that we've been able to in person, so thank you for that.
Yeah.
So some of the data does look a little bit older. That's just due to how we had to set up the templates for each county. Yeah. We will be going in and updating those, all the data points here within the next 6 months to a year. So you will see some data that's 2017, 2018, that will be updated, especially with the new decennial census that was completed last year. And some of the data sources that we currently use as I went over. So within the NEAP, there's six major sections within the baseline report that we have. As I said before, demographic characteristics, social characteristics, economic characteristics, NAICS, top performing sectors, that's the industry analysis, and then land use and fiscal characteristics. Those five categories are secondary data collected, so from the state and federal agencies as we determined before. And then our sixth section is community assets. That is a first-person data gathering, and more qualitative than quantitative. For Story County, we'll be holding an in-person session tomorrow, I believe downstairs at 9 a.m. If you'd like to attend, please do so. We greatly appreciate your time there. And we use that. We bring in a small group of community leaders, and we go through an asset mapping process, which I'll go into a little bit more detail here on the next slide. And then we do an online survey as well to the broader community. And then another major aspect of the NEAP, using the data collected from these, is the economic impact models that we're talking about. So these models can be used for, if you wanted to bring in new industry, how are they going to impact the local community? You're speaking about the housing issues that Story County has, which every single county has, as we've been finding out through our journey throughout the state. So these economic impact models can be used on new housing surveys or studies. Our program is working with Humboldt County currently on a housing study there. We've been approached by Douglas County as well, and Lincoln County on some similar items. So those regional development authorities have found our data helpful, and our team can always assist in that as well. So for the community assets, as I said, the sixth section of our report, my colleague, Dr. Marlene Ribori, who's a community facilitator, specialist for extension, she leads the small group in community assets. So community assets being either concrete or non-concrete, intangible items, things that are important to your local community. So obviously Virginia City is rife, that's a bad connotation, but a lot of history here, a lot of incredible museum just downstairs. And that's something that's an asset to the community. It brings in tourism, it brings a sense of belonging to your local community members. So this process that we do is just a snapshot of what do we see as important and also what do we see as missing. In other committees that we've gone to, things that are always brought up, broadband access, high-speed internet, child care is always lacking even in the larger communities. In small communities, sometimes it can be hospitals or urgent care centers, things of that nature. So within this process, we're bringing this information, then we can share it with the local decision makers, the commissioners. We've been told in a few of our areas that the commissioners didn't realize that some of these things were such an issue or such a priority for their constituencies. So it's been a good part of our program thus far. Okay, key industry assessment. As the public land agencies are one of our major supporters of this project, we focused on the three major items that are on public land throughout Nevada. So that's agriculture, mining, and outdoor recreation. So here we're going to have, for each county, doing a assessment on those lands, what they do for the economic impact of that land comparatively. Agriculture and mining, that's pretty straightforward. For the outdoor recreation, that's not nearly so much. And that's due to the fact that outdoor recreation isn't its own industry. It's a conglomeration of many industries. And it's a little difficult to measure those. You have to look at people that are recreating from your community, people that are recreating from outside the county, but perhaps from within Nevada, from people out of state. Are they flying in? Are they driving in? Are they staying in a hotel? Are they camping in a tent? All these things. So we're working together with the public land agencies, with the new division of outdoor recreation headed by Colin Robertson. We're working with NDOW as well on how do we best measure these things. We just finished up a survey with the Nevada Department of Wildlife on with their hunters. We sent a survey out to all of the registered hunters from the last 2 years, I believe, and got back over 2,000 responses. And it's a step-by-step expenditure pattern. What do they spend? How much do they spend on equipment? How much do they spend on fuel? How much do they spend on guide services? Do they stay in a hotel? Do they stay in a motel? Do they camp? Do they come 1 day, 3 days, 5 days? And from these patterns, we can determine the economic impact that they have to the local community, to perhaps the surrounding communities, and what do these lands mean specifically to the county. This unfortunately doesn't apply to Story County nearly as much as some of the other counties, but this was just for hunting. There's not a lot of hunting done in Story County. However, there's obviously a lot of other outdoor recreation done in Story County. So we did this as a kind of a pilot program. It's turned out incredibly well. We got an incredible amount of participation, and we'll be working with our partners and other state agencies to try to get this into more than just our hunting, into more program areas or outdoor recreation areas. And then some of the deliverables. So prior to the presentation, I had sent the first draft of our baseline report and then our infographic fact sheets. So the infographic fact sheets are just front and back, little two-page document that gives a little brief highlights of each of those five sections that I had spoken about, the demographic, social characteristics, and whatnot. The baseline report is a solid 150 pages, so if you ever have problems going to sleep, go ahead and pull that buddy open. But it does go into a lot more detail into that trend data and whatnot. And then from those items, we can do specialized reports. So one of the first items that we did was mountain biking paths in Caliente and in Lincoln County in general. That was on BLM lands. So we were able to determine what the economic impact of those lands could be if we converted it from, you know, just a plain mountainside to mountain biking paths. And there's two ways to do that. For Caliente specifically, we said, here's what could happen. Because right now, obviously, it's a small town, small area. But if you did bring in these mountain biking paths, it has the opportunity of bringing in thousands of visitors. Mountain Biking Association can do events there, which they are doing. We could increase the hours of coffee shop, of restaurants, which they have. The restaurants there not only increased their hours, but bought out the people next to them to expand their seating. A mountain biking shop opened up and is thriving as well. So these things that we can show not only is going to support your current businesses, but new entrepreneurs can come in as well. We were also instrumental in the lithium mining in Humboldt County and showing the economic impact to Winnemuck and the other local communities there, and that is going forward as well. And as I said before, we're in the process of some other things with Humboldt County Housing and some other items. And that is all I have. So if you have any questions, I am happy to answer.
Fantastic. Thank you. Let's go to public comment and see if there's any public comment. Let me jump on Zoom and see if there's anybody. Anybody on Zoom have any comments or questions regarding this item? No? Commissioner Gilman, do you have any questions?
No, just a thank you to the university. You know, over the years, we have enjoyed and used so much of the data that they have accumulated. It's been very beneficial in attracting new companies and in answering so many of the questions of the community. So I'm glad to see this kind of data being collected, and I thank the university to take on the challenge.
Indeed. Thank you, Lance. Vice Chairman Mitchell?
No, thank you.
I don't have anything right now, but some of that mountain bike data, we actually potentially could find some of that useful. Mm-hmm. I know that Denny's been looking at potentially using some of that for our tourism stuff. So, I don't have any questions at the moment. But thank you for the presentation, and I'm sure we'll reach out and possibly use some of that data for ourselves. So,
well, thank you very much, and yes, please give us a contact anytime for anything that we can help you with. It's great.
Definitely.
Appreciate it.
Yep, did a great job. Thank you again.
Thank you.
All right, moving right along to item number 13. This is a discussion only. No action will be taken. Mark Regan, Fire Mitigation Specialist, Fire Chief for NV Energy, Nevada Energy, will explain the expansion of its Public Safety Outage Management, otherwise known as PSOM program, and changes that will be coming to Story County. Presentation will include what is PSOM, what mitigation efforts NV Energy is already doing, implemented public outreach, in customer resource centers. You have the floor.
Thank you.
Good to see you again.
Good seeing you. Good morning still. Yeah, I wanted to make sure. I'd like to thank everyone for allowing NV Energy to do this presentation. Today I'm going to just do some quick highlights of what is Senate Bill 329 and what is the NDPP, the Natural Disaster Protection Plan, and what are the changes that we're seeking approval for, and how does that impact Story County and some of the Virginia City and Virginia City Highlands areas. We'll wait for the presentation to come up. it's not switching. So what I'm going to do is just like I already did, I'm just going to skip to the third slide when she gets it up and running. So the Natural Disaster Protection Plan was a requirement of Senate Bill 329, last legislation. It was brought forward by the fire chiefs in Northern Nevada, and the Nevada Fire Chiefs Association brought it forward that required the utility companies to present a Natural Disaster Protection Plan to the Public Utility Commission by June 1st of 2020. Having updates to that plan every year, and then submitting the whole plan again every 3 years. So the Natural Disaster Protection Plan does not just focus on wildland, even though wildland is the highest risk in the state of Nevada as a disaster, but it also focuses on earthquakes, the snow events that we have, monsoon season down in the Las Vegas area, high wind events. And so it focuses on not just on wildland, but that is the highest impact in the state of Nevada. During this last year of just implementing the plan was approved last August, August 20th of 2020 by the Public Utility Commission. We have submitted an update in March to make some modifications to the plan. And with any plan, it's always a fluid plan. To make a good plan is allowing to have updates to it, to make adjustments with latest technology, with changes of the community, changes of the environment. So this plan is continually going to be updated. Last year in 2019, we were able to, since 2019, able to inspect over 40,000 wooden poles in the Tier 3 areas. The Tier 3 area is, we broke it into three zones, three tiers. So Tier 3 is the Lake Tahoe Basin and the Mount Charleston Basin. Tier 2 area is going to be like the Virginia City Highlands fuel type, coming off the mountain ranges off Lake Tahoe Basin. And the Tier 1 area is going to be the valley areas, which is the cheatgrass, sagebrush areas. So within the Tier 1 and Tier 2 areas, we were able to inspect over 40,000 poles. In the Tier 3 area alone, we were able to trim or remove over 37,000 unhealthy trees that were in and around the infrastructure in the Tahoe Basin. So it's quite a bit of work. Also, what we have done is expanded our fuels treatments, and I'll go into that a little bit later on. But we also installed 30 weather stations throughout the state of Nevada. These weather stations are a complement to what's already out there, but it focuses on how our infrastructure is going to react during these disasters. With these weather stations, we're seeking approval to add additional 35, which we've submitted that request to the Public Utility Commission in March and should have an answer sometime within the next month on that. Also, we've done is added additional 10 fire cameras. The fire cameras that UNR has started years ago, they have them across the West Coast now. So we added 10 additional fire cameras to the state of Nevada, and all those cameras will be the first ones in the state of Nevada to add automatic intelligence, where we'll be able to identify the difference between a dust devil, a smoke, a fire start, so and then the cameras will alert us, and we'll be able to send the quicker response. By right now, everyone has to be watching the cameras in order to detect a fire. Now we're going to be adding onto the cameras that NV Energy owns all that intelligence to that. We're also seeking. We're also adding additional 10 cameras, so we'll have a total of 20 cameras in the state of Nevada, adding to the system that we have. One of the other programs that we're doing is hardening our system. So during a disaster, making sure we can recover the system a lot faster, provide the reliable energy back to the community faster. So this is the fire mesh program that we have tested out in our Tier 3 area down in Juneau. We've done 170 poles where we wrapped them with a fire mesh. It's heavy gauge chicken wire, basically, with a special fire coating on it when it comes impacted with 300 degrees. It swells up like a marshmallow and protects the pole. We tested it out in Carson City where we actually put fire to the pole, burned the pole for completely burned it for about 14 minutes, 10 minutes at that intensity. We were able to cut away the fire mesh, certify the pole again. We have power back onto that pole, and that's in our parking lot, and we have a light back onto it. So it works. You'll see this on all new rebuilds in our area, on wooden poles in the wildland urban interface areas. We'll be adding the fire mesh, and we'll be seeking approval to in September with the Public Utility Commission to adding it to existing poles in the wildland urban interface area. Going on to our fuels treatments, in the state of Nevada alone, we've treated over 9,000 acres so far since this program has started. What we did was, for years, we've always trimmed the trees and trimmed them back. Well, we've enhanced the program and also came in line with the the Urban Interface Wildland Code that's adopted by the state and also adopted by this board here, where it requires additional work. Pole grubbing, it's called, where we remove the vegetation around the base of the pole. It's going to be anywhere from 10 feet to 30 feet on removing the vegetation, but also creating fuel breaks. Part of the Senate Bill 329 requires us to line up with the CWPPs, the Community Wildland Protection Plans, so creating fuel breaks using our infrastructure. Well, we've done this with quite a few communities, and you're seeing this work done in the you'll see this work being done in the Highlands, but also you see this work up Six Mile Canyon that your fuels crew has been doing. It's not just the work in the Tier 1 and Tier 3 areas. This is all in all three tiers, and also in the lower lying areas that are in just the Urban Interface Wildland Code areas. We're creating these fuel breaks where we're going to go all the way out in some areas out to 1,000 feet outside of our right-of-way. We have the rights to work in the right-of-ways, but we're partnering with landowners, U.S. Forest Service, BLM, and seeking permission and doing surveys to do a larger fuel breaks where we're actually doing able to do, not saying we're going to remove 1,000 feet of vegetation, we're going to remove the vegetation inside the right-of-way and then doing additional fuels treatments outside up to 1,000 feet. It's not just our workforce is not just manpower or woman power, it's goats too. We have Spanish goats, anywhere from 250 to 400 goats that we have in certain areas, also doing our targeted grazing program and doing part of these treatments, fuels treatments around the community. As you can see there, this is just one of the clearing of the vegetation. Some of those are in the 6 Mile Canyon area, before and after pictures of removing the vegetation. This is a fuel break that we've created in the Jacks Valley area, John Squaggs Ranch area, where we've created, used our infrastructure to create a fuel break and done this work. During the fire that the chief mentioned earlier, we were just doing the fuels treatments in the area around the community. This also helped the opportunity for the firefighters to protect the community, kept the fire out of the community with these fuel breaks, gave the a fighting chance to protect the community. Right-of-way clearing, this is just some more right-of-way clearings that we're doing. This is the first phases that you see in the Tahoe Basin of us clearing the pole grubbing and also creating the resilient corridor project is what we call it. Before and after pictures of pole grubbing. As you can see, it's pretty thick stuff sometimes. And now this is in Story County. On our red flag days, we increased the staffing. Our workforce that we have partners with Story County and throughout the state of Nevada with the fire agencies, red flag days, they can't be out doing work in the wildland area because of risk of the threat of starting a fire. So on the red flag days, when we increased the fire standby, they were able to use hand tools, thin the vegetation around the last known hose shed here right in Story County. So when they're doing red flag standby, they have our pole right there. It's right in our right-of-way. So they were able to clear that. So it's not just it's the environment we're concerned about. It's the residents we're concerned about and the historical areas in the state of Nevada that we're concerned about. NV Energy's priority is safety is number one. But we also cares about the environment. Here is Story County 6 Mile Project. Your fuels crew in the last couple months has been able to treat almost 10 miles of fuel line in that steep terrain. Everyone knows 6 Mile Canyon is not the easiest to work. This is just the first phase of it. We're going to be going back with the crew and doing additional phases where we're going to take additional fuels out of there and also go into those zones 2 and 3 that we talked about going out further. We're still working with BLM on approvals on that process. Whoops. This is just some of the equipment and some of the programs that we have. The equipment you see here, these are the fire rigs that we were able to partner with the fire agencies and provide, where they work off this apparatus. Your apparatus is still being built and should be arrived here shortly. The chip truck there you see is also an educational campaign. On both sides, we have some kind of educational message with websites that the community can go to. It really works. We're working with the chief right now on possibility of a chipper for this area, also a chip truck. Just talking about some of the things that happened over the last year. On the fire response, last year we did have a possible 7 PSOM events in the northern Nevada area, where we de-energized in the Tahoe Basin. we were able to look at the system and get to the point where we're able to divert some power off the mountaintops and keep the power on in the residential area. So we look at different ways of being able to not have to piece on a community. There's multiple steps of what we do. During the fire season mode, during the wildland season, we turn our system into the fire season mode, which means it's a single shot where if something touches our lines and causes a fault, it de-energizes the line. Where normally sometimes you have the light flicker three times, the system's trying to figure out what's touching the line and tries to clear it and re-heal itself. During every time that happens, a possible spark could happen. So now our system in wildland mode is in wildland mode for most of the areas in the tier 3 area and tier 2 areas. And then when it comes to a red flag day, we can switch our system over to that further circuits into that to protect that. And so we're able to avoid a PSOM area last year in Lake Tahoe Basin. But we did have some PSOM events down in Mount Charleston. We did one a couple days ago. We've had a total of 4 down in Mount Charleston area and additional possible ones down there. It's dry out there this year, so we're possibly having more events. Also, what we did is we respond to lessons learned. We respond to communications. Communication is a big thing. Making sure during a disaster, communications is one of the first things that go down. What happens is when power goes out, everyone goes from their data, from their Wi-Fi, switches to the cell service, and the cell service system gets overloaded with all the data, starts shutting down. The first thing that goes away on cell service towers is data. Then it goes to communications and then text. So if you're ever in a disaster, the first thing you should do is switch your phone off of iMessages and go to text messages, and that's the last thing that will be turned off on the cell system, so you can communicate with your loved ones, making sure they know where to meet up and also that you're okay. So with that, what we're doing is increasing our cell services, where we do have a contract with FirstNet, AT&T, and Verizon to provide COWs, which is called cell on wheels, communication on wheels. But with COVID and fires going on, it's hard to get these resources. So NV Energy has purchased 12 of these, which will be in the area by the end of this month, and we'll be able to deploy these to provide additional cell service, Wi-Fi connections in the area during a disaster and also during a PSOM event. Some of the additional resources that we've increased across the state of Nevada with this program in the last year, we increased over 21 engines, additional fire engines, one water tender, 7 masticators, 5 chip trucks, 2 track chippers, and we increased to 150 additional firefighters. By the end of the month, we should have almost additional 170 firefighters in the state of Nevada. Additional, we increased to 30 tree trimming crews, also on top of our fuels crew. These are the cell on wheels that we have ordered, which we'll be able to easily deploy. We'll have a couple of them stationed down in Las Vegas and Elko, and the majority of them up here in the northern Nevada area. Some of the undergrounding, we are still looking at undergrounding. Our program is a multi-approach program where we're going to system harden, where we change out some of the poles to metal poles, change out the type of wire, where a tree can actually be leaning against the wire and not cause a problem, change out the type of fuses, and also undergrounding where possible. Undergrounding is expensive and also takes a lot of permitting to get done, and it's not always the fix for everything based on the weather conditions, high snow areas. It takes a while to locate the vault during high snow areas. So these are just some of the programs we are looking at and have approval for undergrounding. Public safety outage management is, we call it a PSOM for short. So it's where we're part of Senate Bill 329 requires us to have some kind of PSOM event plan. And now we already talked a little bit about it for the Tahoe Basin area. And we're seeking approval to expand that to a Tier 2 and Tier 1 areas. The Tier 1 and Tier 2 areas obviously will include the Story County areas. I'll go on a little bit more detail on that and what we're seeking for approval for and what we would provide to the citizens of Story County. During the PSOM event, we will provide CRCs, Customer Resource Centers. These Customer Resource Centers are areas where citizens can get information and provide services. It's not an evacuation center, but I'll go into a little bit more in a couple slides. During the PSOM event, before we do a PSOM event, we do reach out to all of our stakeholders. We reach out to the fire chief, emergency managers of the area, making sure they're seeing the same conditions that we're seeing, and then also about any large events, impacts, and then also we reach out to our community elected officials before a PSUM event happens. During our public safety outage, communications is a big deal. We will be communicating to the public. We have multiple campaigns going on right now. We just, as you heard about the program at the Virginia City Highlands, we're going around to the communities at homeowners events, providing our own homeowners events, teamed up with Living with Fire, and doing a UNR broadcast. We're also sending out letters to the communities, so you'll be receiving a letter in the mail, also emails. So it's very important to go to My NV Energy account and sign up with your latest information. If you change your phone number, you'll get the latest information via text, email, and a phone call during a public safety outage management or any type of disaster. So it's important to go onto our website and sign up, and also download the app on your phone so you'll be able to get the communications. But you'll see a lot of push out of this information. We have news media, paid media. You're going to see some billboards. We sponsor some billboards with Living with Fire. And also on our social media, we're going to be pushing out a lot of information, informing the citizens that they could be in a possible PSUM, or they are in a possible PSUM area where we possibly de-energize. The maps will be updated on our map, on our website and our social media site. So these citizens will be informed. On the communications, we will inform the citizens 48 hours prior to an event happening. As long as we know the event's going to happen, we always are checking the weather 8 days out. We're always predicting 8 days out or further. But as everyone knows around the weather, it's hard to predict. But as it gets closer, we start doing the community outreach to the citizens around 48 hours. The elected officials, law enforcement, fire agencies, if we know, we'll notify them earlier and working with them on that. Another important thing is Green Cross customers. If you're a Green Cross customer where you rely on the power for life-saving devices, it's important to sign up for that program on our website or call our number and sign up, get the packet, make sure you qualify, and we put you into our system where we will notify you earlier, and we could also assist you on your medical needs on having power. So there's multiple different ways we can do that. And so just make sure you call us or sign up on our website or make the phone call if you're a Green Cross customer that you rely on power for your life safety event, medical condition. On the Customer Resource Center, we will provide a Customer Resource Center in areas that we have a PSUM event. we've reached out worked with your emergency manager and your fire chief. The Virginia City Highlands Fire Station will be at the Customer Resource Center. That's established for the Virginia City Highlands. And then we also have remote CRCs where if it's not a fixed facility, we'll have our vans and we have some sheds that are going to be able to be deployed, and cargo sheds, so we'll have the same thing that we can provide at a fixed location. So at the CRC, we will provide, the cow will be there, so you'll be able to have your cell service, you'll be able to make Wi-Fi calling, you'll be able to have your internet services there. We'll provide generation, so you'll be able to bring your laptops, your cell phones, charge up your devices. We'll also provide a battery pack for your cell phones, a car charger, so you can charge the battery pack and also charge your cell phones. The battery packs we provide to last about 4 or 5 charges per cell phone. And then also latest information. We'll provide the latest information on the outages and the recovery. And then also ice will be provided there. So ice and water. So we'll inform the citizens to make sure they can take care of their animals prior. So fill up your water troughs for your horses and animals. And then we'll provide bottled water and ice so you can take the ice, bags of ice home, put them in your refrigerator, and keep your refrigerator and your food cold. Our goal is to restore the power within 24 hours after the event. So the CRCs will be opened from 8 to 8. And they're not an evacuation center, so it'll be closed at night. But as soon as the wind event is over, we have to patrol the lines before we re-energize them. Yeah, that's the only way to make sure nothing is on the lines before we re-energize them. During the nighttime, it's hard for us to patrol the lines. So if the event ends at 7 o'clock at night, we would not be able to start patrolling the lines until about daylight, 5 a.m. or 6 a.m., depending on the sun. As soon as daylight hits, we do the patrols and re-energize. Our goal is to re-energize within 24 hours after the wind event happens. So if it's a two-day wind event, we could be looking at longer outages. We do have some options of a drive-through, options where citizens can pull in, grab the to-go bag, grab the ice and water, and if they don't need charging, they can move on back to their homes. During the outages, we'll take care of any vegetation issues. We'll have additional law enforcement in the area. We'll have additional crews in the area to handle any type of situation that pops up. Additional fire and vegetation crews. Re-energization, I already went into that. We have to re-inspect every circuit before we re-energize it. These are just the thresholds that we have for the Tahoe Basin from last year. We changed our process that we did last year. The thresholds that we had set didn't capture the true conditions of the late fire season. The ERC and the Fosberg Weather Index doesn't capture the live fuel and the colder temperatures. It throws those charts off. And so we've changed our model this year, working with what the study was done that was over in California, and also working with our expert working group that we have, and changed it where we use the burn index. The burn index is well known throughout the fire agencies. It captures the late season wind events and the true conditions out there. We do fuel sampling every week of the fuels, still, when you input it into the models and using the ERCs and the Fosberg, it still didn't capture that because of the colder temperatures. We saw this in the late season events that we have in October, November, and December in this area. So we changed it to a burn index and the wind. The burn index is how it was 70 for the Tahoe Basin and 70 for Mount Charleston, and the wind gusts at 40 and 45. Now, it doesn't mean as soon as we hit the 40 mile an hour winds, we're going to turn off the power. Hey, I have to have the fuel type there. Earlier this year in Tahoe, we've had winds over 60. We didn't de-energize because the fuel conditions were not there. And we take into consideration all other aspects, true conditions, working with the fire agencies. For the this is just why we switched over. I already talked about it. Didn't capture the late season events and the true conditions out there. We had some good fire behavior with the ERCs lower than 92%, which was our threshold. During the Pine Haven fire that started, which we believe was started by a campfire, it was at 60% ERC, and so those were the conditions that were burning on that. So it didn't meet the thresholds, but again, we believe the fire started by an illegal campfire. The Tier 1 and Tier 2 areas, we're going to be using the true conditions out there and not have set thresholds because of the fuel types and how spread out the territory is on the Tier 1s, Tier 2. What we have in Story County is a little bit different than what we have in Elko and Douglas County. So we're going to be using the red flag warning system that the National Weather Service provides. And then we'll be reaching out to the local National Weather Service, the local fire agency, emergency managers, and seeing what the true conditions are, what the winds are looking like, and also looking at our system. Where have we done improvements to it and made it system hardened? Where we're able to do veg management work, and if it is really necessary to have to piece on with the true conditions. And so it's more of a true conditions versus just using a threshold model on this for the Tier 1 and Tier 2. The expanded areas, these are just goes into the Tier 3, Tier 1, and Tier 2 areas. Tier 3 is the darker orange is the Tahoe Basin, and then the lighter color orange is the Tier 2, and then the Tier 1 is the elevated areas. As you can see, these are the where we're expanding the tiers, the zones in Quasho and Douglas, and then Virginia City Highlands and Virginia City. Virginia City Highlands is a Tier 2, and Virginia City is a Tier 1 area. And so we'll be working with constantly with your emergency manager and your fire agencies if it gets close to a peace zone event, but we're also preparing for that. The community has the volunteers working with the emergency manager that are going to help staff the CRCs. So the volunteers of the community are going to be helping NV Energy do that staffing. So we appreciate that. And if we have an event here in Virginia City itself where we have to de-energize, We would also work with the emergency manager on picking a location for a CRC. But we have our staff ready to go. We're going to be having exercises, stand table exercises, tabletop exercises, and full-scale exercises, which your emergency manager and your fire agencies will be invited to. I appreciate the partnership that we've created with Story County, with the fire agencies. We're looking at expanding that partnership that we have with you guys. It has made an effort. The last 2 weeks, there has been fire starts around the fuels projects, not in the fuel projects, but around the fuels projects. The fire agencies were able to jump on them, keep them small. In this last 2 weeks, over 10 fires have started where our crews were out working and we'll keep them small. Just the other day, Reno had one from fireworks. They were able to keep it small, and also responding to Douglas County was a big response. Questions and answers?
Is there any public comment? Anybody on Zoom?
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, looks like Chris Thompson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chris Thompson, Tall Reef. First, I'd like to thank NDE for all the support that they've given us, and they've really expanded their capabilities out here at TRI. I just have a couple questions. Number one, under this new plan, what tier is Tahoe Reno Industrial Center put in? Second, has there been an analysis about the redundancy of the transmission and distribution lines out here and any wargaming done about what happens if a particular line goes down from fire or a car or truck taking down a pole, to just make sure we've got alternate routes to for the power? Third, what is the crews, I think, are based out of the District 2 offices for the repairs. Is that correct? And if so, what is their normal response times under this plan to TRI? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Excellent questions. I'll probably forget one of them or two of them.
You
so,
sure?
Yeah, I'll start from the back. The crews do respond out of Reno, and we also have the crews that will respond out of our remote locations. And our crews, so reliability, we do look at our system to have multiple, especially in that area there, we have multiple feeds going out to that area. So if one line goes down, we already have our system control that have the switching orders to do the switching based on the load at that time and that time of the day to have redundant power for those areas. That system was built with redundant power where not all areas do have that capabilities. And so like Virginia City has that capabilities, TRI, but there are some communities that only have one circuit going out to them. We're looking at that. We're identifying that in these in our updates, and if we'll be submitting any updates to the Public Utility Commission for those approvals. Tier, right now, your area falls into a non-tier area, but you fall into the wildland urban interface area. So as the program is being updated, that area will become a tier one area. And we are already working with the fire agencies to start doing the fuels mitigation treatments around those infrastructures that are out there, creating nice fuel breaks. We're developing a plan on developing fuel breaks around the infrastructure out there. Now, is it going to be able to be accomplished overnight? No. All that stuff, system hardening takes permitting, approvals through the Public Utility Commission and permitting. Infrastructure, if we're doing the vegetation around their infrastructure, it's going to take us 9 to 12 years to get the infrastructure vegetation under control statewide. But we have the higher priority areas that we can accomplish in a timely manner. We're attacking those first, and then it's a year-round program. And where we can put fuel breaks in the areas, we'll be creating fuel breaks. But in their area, in the TRI area, we have some really great infrastructure out there where we can do some really nice fuel breaks. And so we're already working with the fire agencies to implement those fuel breaks. It'll be nice wide fuel breaks. So if a lightning bust happens or a vehicle fire or a human-caused fire happens, it will help the firefighters contain the fires by using that infrastructure. Did I answer all three questions or did I miss one?
Did he cover you, Chris?
Sir, what's the response time planned for for a down distribution line at TRI, what's the response time to get a crew on site from District 2? Thank you.
We always have a crew on call if it's after hours. To give you a set time of, okay, it's 20 minutes, 25, it's based on the conditions. Obviously, when a storm front moves or a fire condition happens or a disaster is going on, our response times could be extended. During a high wind event, we do bring on additional staffing, but on a normal day, if a vehicle would take up a pole in your area during the day, our crews are always responding, so it would be drive time from the Reno area where they would be dispatched from. But after hours, again, they're on call, or if the system is overwhelmed, just like a fire agency or law enforcement, if it's overwhelmed, it could be extended response time. But our, you know, we always have a crew on time, so I couldn't give you an exact time. But today, right now, if something happens, it would be a response from the Reno yard.
Great. Thank you for the answers. And I know you've really beefed up your redundancy at TRI. I just request on our part, and thanks for all the efforts out there on building redundant lines. To me, just from what I've seen over the last decade, is redundancy is everything out there, and having your parts on hand in case there is a single line somewhere, to have that stood up in a hurry. We got $15 billion in plant and equipment, and if power goes down, it can do a lot of damage. But again, NV Energy has been doing a great job out there on building in that power infrastructure. Thank you for all your efforts by you and your company. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Is there any other public comment
for Mark?
Commissioner Gilman, do you have any questions for Mark?
I do not. Thank you.
Vice Chairman Mitchell?
I don't, no, thank you. It was a good presentation. We were both able to be at the one in the Highlands this last weekend, and so good information. Happy to know, kind of get ahead of things as we're headed into what could be a rough fire season.
Yeah, it's already pretty dry out there.
Right. I'm proud to say my generator was ready on Saturday. So
thank you.
I got it all ramped up. Thank you for being here. Thank you for the presentation. That's it.
I appreciate it. And then since you mentioned generators, we do have a safety message on our website. If you're using a generator, you want to make sure it's away from your house for CO poisoning. Make sure it's not close to an opening. Make sure it's outside. And then make sure it's clear of any vegetation. And then so you don't start a fire. And then make sure it's properly installed and hooked up to your house. Have a certified electrician do that.
Yeah. All right, so do not keep it in my kitchen.
Don't keep it in the kitchen. Or your garage. A lot of people were starting to run them in the garage during Texas, during the cold, and we've lost quite a few people from CO poisoning. So.
Yeah, indeed.
So, all right, thank you.
Thank you. All right, we're going to go to item number 14, then we're going to take a 10-minute break. So you just made it, Mr. Poole. This is for discussion and possible action, consideration and possible approval of the acceptance of renewal proposal from Nevada Public Agency Insurance Pool and approval of payment from fiscal year 2021 to 2022 funds.
A couple of handouts for you guys here.
Thank you.
All right. Hello. Thank you for taking the time to chat with us today. On record, my name is Kayla Woods. I'm a sales executive with A&H Insurance. And to my right, I have Brad Pierce, chairman of A&H and my partner in managing the accounts that we have with the pool. And Wayne Carlson, executive director of NPAIP, Nevada Public Agency Insurance Pool. Sorry, I'm dealing with some allergies, so bear with my voice here. So I wanted to start out giving you a little history of A&H Insurance. So we're a family-owned and operated agency. We have been in Reno, Nevada since 1957, and we're one of the few independent agencies still left in the Reno, Nevada area. What's happening is a lot of big companies from out of state are coming in and purchasing the independent agencies that once were in Nevada. So we have boots on the ground here. We're in this community. We have skin in the game, and we really care about our clients and our members, especially to this program, the pool. For those of you who have dealt with the insurance renewals in the past, my face is new this year. So Carol Ingalls was a wonderful lady, and she passed away earlier this year due to COVID, and so I am honored to be able to follow in her footsteps and start advocating for the counties that are members of the pool. She actually, Story County was one of the first members to join the pool back in 1987, and she has been servicing you guys ever since you joined. So definitely honored to take that over and, like I said, continue to walk in her footsteps. What ANH does, as far as the relationship with the pool does, with the pool, is we're advocates for the county. So we're advocates for Story County. We want to make sure that you guys are having a good experience, you're getting the exceptional service you need, and that you're able to take care of all the value-added services that the pool offers. So that's one of the huge advantages to the pool. There are several different types of insurance markets out there. There's the admitted markets that probably you guys have heard of, like Hartford, Liberty Mutual, Travelers, that maybe insure your business or write your homeowner's insurance. We have non-admitted markets like Lloyd's of London or Scottsdale. Those take a little less vanilla risk, stuff that's a little higher risk. Think about contractors, manufacturers, that kind of thing. And then for really complex entities like counties and hospitals and fire departments that have a lot more going on, they don't necessarily fit in the standard market. And back in 1987, this created a huge issue. You know, where do you guys go to still indemnify yourselves from major loss? Well, that is why Wayne created the pool, and that is why you guys joined the pool, is to be able to get the best coverage, the broadest coverage, at the most affordable price. And we work together with the pool as your agent to ensure that that's happening. So I'm going to pass it on to Brad here. He's going to talk a little bit about the renewal this year and some changes. And then I'll give a little summary of what Austin's looking at right now, and then we'll let Wayne talk about some of those value-added services.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, commissioners. Brad Pierce for the record. In your agenda packets, I know that there was an 18-page proposal slash handout, and I'm going to touch on only a couple of items within that, so we will keep it brief here. But the key element initially wanted to discuss the, which is on page 3, if anyone's following that. It's basically the state of the insurance marketplace nationally. Again, I think we're all aware of so many things that are going on, but number one, on the property side of the insurance arena, with the catastrophic wildfires, the various elements of the pandemic, which is prompted so many business interruption types of claims and various other elements. The marketplace is in a great deal of upheaval in reference to that. The reinsurers who insure the insurance companies are having a great deal of stress and are putting a lot of strain on the marketplace. In addition to that, on the casualty side, as I think we're all also aware, we're seeing horrendous increases in claim settlements. The preponderance of litigation and the numbers that are coming into the marketplace as far as claim settlements is quite alarming. Statistically, it's shown in here that I think since 2014, insurance litigation claims have gone up by some 314% as far as the settlement amounts. You're starting to see new terms in the marketplace, what are called nuclear verdicts, verdicts in excess of $100 million. They have no correlation to the policies that are in place. It's just the whim of the social element out there as far as what seems to be right at that point in time. So there's just no common sense in a lot of these areas. And finally, I would comment on the cyber aspect. It's a new element in the insurance arena, arena over the last probably 5 to 8 years. It's growing leaps and bounds as far as the elements and the costs that it's making the insurance carriers incur. We're seeing, as is stated here, pricing increases in the 25 to 40%, you know, across the board in cyber, the cyber arena. So with that kind of as a bad backdrop, but a backdrop, I would reference basically some of the coverages that are within the pool itself, and they have not changed this year. You have an excellent complement of coverages. There are basically four arenas, if you will, the property side of it, the liability, cyber, and then environmental, which has become such a major element also. But just as a very quick overview, Story County maintains a $5,000 maintenance deductible. It's something that we're going to come back to very quickly at the end of this presentation. But as far as the property side, there's an overriding blanket limit of $300 million. Story County has insurable values of about $90 million, if I remember correctly. We'll see that, though. But an overriding limit of $300 million. You have earthquake and flood coverages of $150 million in limits. The thing I would point out about that is that the same maintenance deductible, that $5,000 that's currently in place, would stand over both of those elements, which is somewhat unheard of in the marketplace. Typically, it's subject to a much greater percentage deductible, if you will. On the liability side, you maintain basically $10 million in limits on a per occurrence and an aggregate basis, which is excellent coverage parts for you. There is the sexual abuse and molestation, which has a sublimit of $2.5 million, but it is something that's really impacting the marketplace also at this point in time. As Kayla pointed out, you know, A&H has been really very proud to be part of this through Carol Engel's efforts since, again, 1987 when this program was created, and had maintained coverages for you since that point in time. The next element is, again, as I mentioned, the cyber risk piece. Currently, there's a $3 million limit that's available, which is certainly an excellent limit within the marketplace. And finally, I would comment about your environmental liability. There's a $2.5 million, a $2 million per incident and a $10 million aggregate limit as far as that piece of the coverage parts. So say those four components pretty much make up a very, very broad program for you. Having said that, just a couple of things very specific to Story County. Number one, your payrolls have remained very close to what they were the prior year, $10.5 million in payrolls, $89 million, I think I said 90 as far as insured values. Your auto count, and Jennifer pointed this out to us, that there was a tremendous effort to get rid of a lot of your older vehicles, hopefully with a cost savings aspect to it, but you went from 166 vehicles to a current number of 140 vehicles. Your employee count is up from 136 to 144 individuals, and your officer count remains the same at 27. I want to just very quickly touch on the claims aspect. Your frequency and severity of claims has actually trended down over the last couple of years. And having said that, though, I wanted to point out that in the 2015-16 policy year, you had in excess of a $500,000 claim during the course of the year. And unfortunately, the trending on a 2016-17, due to flood and storm losses in January of 17, are now in excess of $1.2 million. So those things have been obviously taken into account in all of the pricing mechanisms. So with all that information, and I hope I touched on it fairly quickly for you, what is being proposed by the NPAIP is an annual premium of $451,000, which is up 9.1% over last year. Having said that, at a pre-meeting with several of the county officials, there was discussion of the number of claims, the claims elements, as relates to the deductible that's currently in place. And so with that, I'm going to turn this back over to Kayla, who had done a quick analysis or an analysis for the county and have some recommendations, which I think you have in front of you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello again. Hello. So lots of coverage is there. Probably sounds a lot like gibberish to most of you guys. So just know, we are your experts. We are your advocates. If there's more information that you ever want on what these coverages do for you, how they work, what they provide, we are always available to give real-life examples of how these coverages are going to respond in your real-life scenario. So with the increase in premium, a lot of times what we do in order to mitigate that is look at increasing the deductible. So the deductible is what you pay in order for coverage to kick in. And currently, Story County has a $5,000 deductible, and that's the number Brad just mentioned as far as the renewal premium goes. Now, as I mentioned, increasing that deductible can lower premium, but what that means is you're also taking on additional risk. Now, that being said, a $5,000 deductible, although it used to be very common, is getting less common now because entities are choosing to self-insure a little more and using that deductible as the method to do that. So I have an Excel spreadsheet that I handed out to you guys, and I just want to cover it really quickly. At the top, you're going to see the claims from the last 4 years, so from 2016 to 2017, divided by the claim amount. So under 5,000, under 10,000, under 25,000, and over 25,000. They're also organized by date, so the most recent is at the top, all the way down to the oldest. Now, one thing to keep in mind here is that claims sometimes take a little bit of time to come to fruition. So the most recent claims years, 19 to 20, even 18 to 19, there may still be claims that are coming up or building out or going through the process. So those numbers sometimes can go higher over time. But if you take look down to the two boxes at the bottom, the first one on the left is the averages. So you can see the averages of the claims in each category, under 5, under 10, under 25 for the last 4 years. And in the far right column, you can see the predicted claims. Now, predicted is very loose term here because I only took 4 years of loss history, but the predicted claims based on the last 4 years. So you can see under 5,000 predicted would be $10,170 of incurred losses on average. Under 10K, 16, etc. And then on the right hand, you see the current deductible option. So you see our $5,000 deductible, and I'm in the lower right hand box here. The $5,000 deductible, the $10,000 deductible, and the 25, the premiums associated, and the savings in premiums if you are to increase the deductible. So is everybody with me there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is important because you can see that under $5,000, the average claims is $10,170. If we are to go up to $10,000, $16,024 and some change. If we are to go to the $10,000 deductible, that means that $16,000 is now coming out of your pocket. But by going to the $10,000 deductible, you're saving $24,000 in premium. So overall, my recommendation would be to go to the $10,000 deductible for this term, save some money on the premium. Now, insurance is one part of the risk management pie. You know, there's a lot more that goes into managing your risk as a county. And those are the value-added services that the pool offers. And so taking advantage of those value-added services is going to be very important as we move forward and continue to try to reduce the claims. So it can be really hard for your employees and your managers to know where to start with those value-added services. And I just wanted to make sure it's very clear that I am the place to start. Brad is the place to start. Come to us and we will show you all the things that the pool has to offer because it is a lot, thousands and thousands of dollars in value-added services for you to help mitigate and reduce your risk. So with that, I'm going to have Wayne come on up here and talk about some of those value-added services that the pool offers.
Wayne Carlson, for the record, I'm the executive director of the pool. Yes, I'm the one responsible for getting it going in 1987. So, but I just want to highlight a few of the programs and services, in some of which you are currently actively, very actively using. One is the passive network assessment, which we had our computer IT specialist do for you guys, and a KnowBefore, which is an email phishing training program, which you are active users in. So the passive network assessment resulted in a report and recommendations to your IT staff for ways to beef up your IT security, because obviously the cyber risk is a huge problem, and we want to prevent those losses if at all possible. This last year, we launched on the law enforcement front. We did detention facility assessments. Your initial assessment was done in January of 20, and we did a follow-up in February of this year. And the goal there is to work from best practice guidance, assess your organization, give you a report and feedback, and then a year later, see how it's progressing. So those things were all included in your program. These passive network assessments cost up to $30,000, and the detention facility assessments are $25,000. So they're expensive, but we funded them because it does prevent losses. And Mary didn't talk a whole lot about the law enforcement law bills that changed some of the territory here on law enforcement, but there's increased standards requiring model policies to implement these new standards for how an officer should respond to an incident. Fortunately, a law enforcement consultant has already developed policies along that line before the legislation was even addressed. So we had them already in place within our member agencies. And so we're going to have some minor tweaks to them based on the final language of the legislature, but it's going to be helpful for the board, for the law enforcement agencies to do the training that's necessary for that. Another thing on law enforcement we've launched is monthly roll call webinars, which they highlight a couple of topics, one related to patrol, one to detention, and round table with the experts each month. They had the first one was use of force and restraint chairs, and the one just done on June 20th, mental health concerns for detention facilities and body cams. That's the next one. So we just launched that. We also are working on a program with the human resource services, which are extensive and you guys take advantage of. That's all those HR services. There's a single sheet in your proposal packet that describes the scope of those. We're working on a online sort of webinar interchange roundtable with our law enforcement consultants and our HR attorney that specializes in HR-related issues to talk about HR and law enforcement so we can deal with those issues. And that's planned for July 16th. Another thing that's coming up is we're working with the Sheriff's and Chiefs Association to have a panel discussion on major law enforcement issues that are upcoming, and that'll be in July as well. Swing pool assessments, we include those. The next one for you guys is scheduled in July. And then our safety program, we've beefed that up to where the safety consultants will work with your safety committee doing either training topics or consultation with them as needed. And then one thing that's really been strengthened is the risk management grants. We've had a risk management grant program the pool dedicates between the two programs that we have. We have over $1 million of grants available. And on top of that, we have educational risk management grants, which are up to $2,000 for 5 employees, $2,000 each for every member. So you have an opportunity if it is a risk management reduction program and you need some funding for it, then that's available. The Loss Control Excellence Program was revamped and upgraded, and the amount of the award is increased substantially to where you could earn, based on the scope of the operation, for counties, it's a larger reward, but it could be close to $20,000 award if you achieve all the best practices. And then finally, with Tony Rucci and our cybersecurity, we're doing a first webinar on July 14th. It will be our cybersecurity webinar. And so that'll be coming up. And we're going to do a series of those cyber awareness, cybersecurity training webinars for the members. And you guys are active participants in our Know Before. And then we also have e-learning for all of our programs, from law enforcement to HR to safety. And all those things are available. And folks are taking a lot of taking advantage of it. So with that, I will just refer you to the laundry list of other things I didn't talk about that's in the back of the proposal. There's a page called Risk Management, another one called Human Resources, and those are the scope of things that are included within your program. And with that, I'll stop and respond to any questions you have.
Thank you for that, Wayne. Is there any public comment regarding this item? Anybody out there on Zoom? Keith.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Keith Loomis. I wanted to add to what Wayne said, that when I'm reviewing contracts and I go through the risk management clauses in the contract, I send a lot of those off to Wayne and ask for his comment and get his concerns. And Wayne has always been responded very quickly and effectively, and I just want to let you know that.
Thanks for that, Keith. any other public comment? How about Commissioner Gilman? Do you have any questions?
I kind of want to reserve comment for a bit more discussion, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Vice Chairman Mitchell, anything?
I guess I would have a couple questions for us to discuss if we're looking at potential different deductible levels and kind of impacts and how that would work. But I don't know if we want to launch into that or if we.
I don't see any reason to go any higher than the $5,000 deductible personally, but if we want to engage in discussion, I'm fine with it.
Okay.
County Manager Osborne, you want to weigh in?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. I think there's, excuse me, I think there's a lot of things that want to be said here, but we have talked with these folks and then with our comptroller and myself and others, and just the way the world's going right now, we're recommending to stay with a $5,000 deductible. But at the same time, I'd like to put, you know, a caveat to that, that we spend the next year till the next renewable period really revisiting this, looking at all the data, seeing where we are. We're still offloading cars. We have a couple pieces of equipment we're still trying to get rid of that have been with us for a while that are difficult to unload, and look at some other things. But that we think that, some minor parts on our cars now can easily be $1,500 or more. And there's some building things that we're dealing with right now that could cause some claims to happen that might cause the $5,000 deductible to be advantageous. But we do want to continue looking into this more closely, work with you per quarter or at the midpoint to start looking at recommendations for the next year's renewal.
Sounds logical to me. How do my fellow commissioners feel about that?
So just to make sure that I understand it, but based on the conversations and analysis that you've had so far, you don't feel that the potential projected savings from going to a higher deductible are warranted based on the current situation, or that they would outweigh the added risk or potential burden that would come along with it?
Austin Osborne, for the record, I am happy to, ask folks that are in the room. We got a comptroller here, you folks, to talk about that further. But we do believe at this time it's best to keep that deductible. We think the $24,000 difference, we could exceed that pretty
okay.
easily.
And just to make sure I understand, if it's all right, Mr. Chairman, the claims under $5,000, or excuse me, incidents under $5,000, are those actual claims that were filed, or were those things that we just handled on our own?
They're claims items that were filed, but okay.
Do you mind?
Kayla Woods for the record. So they are claims that were filed, but were not. You did not receive a payment from insurance because they were under that deductible.
Understood. Thank you.
And there are all kinds of things. I mean, you know, snowplow clips a car, causes damage to a fence. There's a county vehicle has a minor accident, hits a pole or something, and, you know, a bumper and a taillight could be pretty expensive. You know, there's all different kinds of things, but a lot of these things are just little minor things that accumulate through the year.
If no payment is made out, does that reflect on our rating? Or I don't know what the proper terminology is, but if a claim is filed but there's no payout that comes out, does that reflect negatively on us as a risk factor?
I'm going to defer to Wayne on this one.
Mm-hmm. They do not. You get a deductible credit for the assumption of risk that you're taking, and so that's why there's a differential. If you took higher risk, then you'd have a credit. So that's designed to offset any of those out-of-pocket expenses.
Great, thank you. All right, well, yeah, I mean, I don't have particularly strong feelings about going one way or the other. I guess I'd be interested to hear what Commissioner Gilman has to say, if he has some thoughts on this one way or the other.
So, Clay, I'm inclined to support what the staff has recommended on this. I do believe our county is in a position, and the world around us, a state of a flux, and with a significant amount of unknowns. But my inclination is that we stay with our $5,000 deductible, and that we take the next year to do a thorough review, research, and consideration, and look at what we're going to do in the next year.
Okay. I mean, I guess the downside that I'm seeing is potentially looking forward to future years. If we keep a $5,000 deductible, we end up incurring several claims in that $5,000 to $10,000 range that could potentially have an adverse effect for pricing going into future years. And so not that that's a reason in and of itself not to do it. That's just a more long-term risk factor that I'm kind of considering.
Commissioner Mitchell, Austin Husband for the record. Actually, I think, you know, that is a good point. That I think if someone would like to talk about that next year when we look at a renewal, are we looking at going out to market or whatever it might be, what might the difference here be in our ability to be competitive?
Yeah, so we will certainly go out to market. So going out to market means we're going to go shop your insurance, and this is a lot of times to the standard market, which is outside the pool. We have shopped other entities' coverage this year, and the property alone was double the cost without any earthquake or flood or cyber or all of those additional coverages that the pool does offer. So, yes, we can definitely shop it. But with the hard insurance market we're in, I'm sure you guys have all experienced increased auto rates, increased in homeowners' insurance rates. It's this litigious society that we're in, and the claims are higher than they've ever been. So across the board, we're seeing market increases. Wayne had shared with us another entity that was with one of the alternatives to the pool saw a 40% increase in their premium this year over last year. So while 9% is a lot, and it definitely affects your budgets and has an effect on the county, it's not as bad as it could be. So I think we should continue to watch it. I think you're correct that having a higher deductible can sort of decrease the amount of money that the insurance company is paying out on your behalf, which can result in a decrease in premium year over year. Now, that being offset by the hard market we're in, I'm not sure if that would be a one-year turnaround, meaning in 12 months we would immediately see that premium go up or down based on those small claims not being on there. Increasing deductibles, you're right, though, is a great way of self-retention, of taking on a little more risk yourself. But I also understand Austin's idea where we can really dig into this year. I'm super excited to be servicing your county and on this account, and I'm going to dig into it and making sure that we can reduce those claims as much as we can, and that we can take advantage of all the free services, the thousands of dollars of free services that the pool is offering, to see if we can lower those claims on their own.
Gotcha. Thank you. And I don't have any delusions that our premiums would go down. I think maybe we would slow the increase is what we would hope for.
If I might, Brad Pierce again. The only thing I would like to throw into this conversation, yes, it would be certainly wise and advantageous to see what the marketplace bears. Right now, the marketplace does not really have a product out there that could assemble the coverage parts that are being provided under this program. Again, that doesn't mean that we wouldn't make the efforts and what have you, but as far as the limits, the aspects of the deductibles on things like the quake and flood, etc., I mean, you just don't find that, and you don't have the ability to assemble that type of a coverage part. The marketplace is very hard, and I guess, you know, again, I would just leave it with that. Realize what you have, that you're a member of something that's been assembled over 37 years here, and it's a tremendous, tremendous product that you've got right now. And again, trying to mitigate and hold the premiums in place is very, very important. But the marketplace is right now in a tremendous state of upheaval. But again, as your agents, that is exactly what we would do. The one thing that I would at least make you aware of is that if there was ever a desire to leave this program, there has to be a notice provided within 120 days of the anniversary of it. So I just want to make sure everyone is clear of that fact. And again, we will certainly work at the county manager's and anyone else's direction as far as what you'd like to see, and we'll most likely be providing the loss follow-up that was done here, maybe on a quarterly basis, if that makes sense to you. So.
Great. Thank you.
Now, this is Wayne. I'd just like to add, the pool is owned by the members, so you are the owners, and the board governs the design of the program, the coverage, the limits, how it works. And we have a very active executive committee of the board that's very involved in the details of the financial structure. In terms of marketing, what we do as a group is, like in the property side, we go to Lloyd's of London. We found that they're the most stable long-term bet market. They play in the long-term arena. They have, it's literally a marketplace in and of itself. The insurance carriers there, the reinsurance carriers we work with, are called syndicates, and they each share a piece of that big structure. And when you look at our diagram, our own reinsurer, that captive that the pool owns, the pool members funded, we take a big share, and we doubled our share of the risk above the retention that we have within the pool itself. So on the reinsurance structure, we went from taking $4 million to $8 million of the risk, above $50 million, up to $300 million. So that's, the property is placed in a market that plays worldwide. And that's the same market that private carriers go to for their reinsurance placements and their relationships. But we are long-term players. We do visit with them every year. When we talk to the lead syndicates, we switch leads when their competitive terms are not there. So we do some of that in detail each year. On the liability side, we work with nonprofit organizations for almost every piece of the program. So there's county reinsurance, which is a pool of pools created through the National Association of Counties under the financial services sector. It's a nonprofit reinsurer. We have an ownership interest as the pool. The members have an ownership interest in county reinsurance. Likewise, we have government entities mutual, which attaches a little higher layer, and that's another pool of pools, nonprofit, owned by the members. So we have one small piece in the layer of $7 million excess of $3 million. That's with a private reinsurer, and they're taking 40% of $7 million excess of $3 million. And then this year, for schools, we had a real market stress. And that is our reinsurer, which is another nonprofit, they had to cut their capacity, increase their pricing dramatically. And so we've used our captive to fill in the gaps, and we got two competitive quotes. And our pricing, filling in the gaps, was equal to or less than the other two competitive markets. So that's how we go about it. It's a complex process. We start with the agents doing the applications in November, December, and due in January. And then we start putting together, going to markets to get quotes from them. So there's a lot of staff work done, a lot of work with the agents. So it's a collaborative relationship. But the goal is to get the best program that your executive committee of the pool, your own organization, is satisfied is the right program for them. Likewise, all of the services. The HR services are through a nonprofit that gets a grant from the pool. And so, again, we try to keep the profit margin out of it and keep it in a nonprofit arena. So, anyway, sorry for the editorial, but I thought it was important to have some history about just what all we do.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah, and I want to be clear. My questions are not necessarily in view of trying to look at some sort of, you know, renegotiation. It's just looking at internal strategy as far as how we handle the premiums. So.
Any other
Mr.
questions?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like you to share some overview thoughts, if I may. I know that the underwriters base their rates on the number of claims and the amount that we're paying. But in my opinion, so much of that is subject to the management of the county and to the mitigation that's internal. So I firmly believe that our management, our departments, the county itself has done a great job in organization and growth and mitigation of the issues that may come up and we may have to address and fight. But it's a complicated subject for me personally. And really what I would recommend at this point is that we stay with our $5,000 deductible, but let's consider bringing in an outside insurance expert that could review our status as a county and where we stand and how this looks. I'd like to have a third party opinion, if you will, and a thorough analysis with something that I don't have a firm grasp on. It's a complicated subject. So that would be my recommendation, that we stay with our $5,000, we stay the course for the year, and we thoroughly review where we stand as a county. But again, I'm going to say that I'm very confident in the county management at this point, and I believe that we have the ability to mitigate a lot of our exposures.
Thank you, Lance. All right. Be comfortable making a motion?
Yeah, I'm happy to. Because we have alternatives presented, do I need to specify the motion is non-specific on the premium or on the deductible? Excuse me.
I would say, go ahead.
Oh, okay, Austin Osborne. Yeah, I think if you go ahead and make the motion, I would put on there what deductible you believe would be appropriate, and I think for you three that would work. That fits all the things that are in here. Okay.
Very good. Then I, Commissioner Mitchell, move to accept the renewal proposal from the Nevada Agency Insurance Pool and approval for payment from fiscal year 2021-2022 funds with a deductible amount of $5,000.
I'll second that motion.
There's a motion and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Motion passes unanimously. Thank you very much. Appreciate all of you coming up. And we're going to go ahead and take a 10-minute recess. We'll see you all back here at 1:25.